Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where their new exhibit, Changing Landscapes, An Immersive Journey, transports you to iconic spots around the globe to see how people are adapting to a changing climate. More at mos.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, 2 weeks before the third congressional primary, Lori Trahan was in fourth place until she got a last-minute infusion of cash. Now an election watchdog group thinks PEDs, as in performance-enhancing donations, could have something to do with her win. If the FEC launches an investigation into Trahan's campaign finances, what's next? We'll take this on and more on today's political roundup. Then Charlie Sennett joins us to talk about Theresa May's Brexit wounds. Her proposals have already been voted down 3 times in a divided parliament. What's at stake if she heads into vote number 4?
Joe Biden is expected to announce his 2020 run any day, but is his signature brand of expressing affection going to be a problem? We open the lines and ask you, in the era of Me Too, is his touchy-feely approach to retail politics a problem? Then Bob Thompson joins us for his take on the 7th and final season of Veep. All that is next on Boston Public Radio. The Eastern Brownie, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Did you take an electric scooter to work? Did you hear what Henry Santora just said?
We're first in Massachusetts with electric scooters. I think it's a very exciting.
So did you scoot your way
in from
Brooklyn?
I did not, Jim. I drove my little electric blue car, but maybe this summer when the weather gets a little bit
warmer. I snowshoe in from Cambridge in the winter, as you know, so there's no reason in any case. For months, Joe Biden has been teasing us with a 2020 run, but what's holding him back? With Anita Hill haunting him and a Nevada assemblywoman saying he inappropriately kissed and touched her, could it be that Biden is unsure how to campaign in the era of Me Too? Joining us for their take on this, Lori Trahan's troubling campaign money trail, and other political headlines are Frank Phillips, State House Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe, Peter Galzanis, columnist emeritus for the Boston Herald. Frank, Peter, good to see you both.
I'm former
nice to be here.
State House Bureau.
Whatever the hell you are. I couldn't say emeritus twice. You know what I mean?
I liked emeritus, too.
Okay. It sounds very distinguished here. We're a very distinguished crew. Well,
so it's two emeriti.
That's not so true. Right.
So let's start with you, former State House Bureau Chief. What does this mean for Biden? Is Biden cooked because he's rubbed too many shoulders?
I think it's marginal. You know, Joe Biden is an older man. He lost his son, and he's very emotional. I can see him being very, you know, he's very hands-on with people, whether women or men. And I think he's got a lot of, you know, empathy about, you know, going on, a lot of emotional things going on. Hey, I just lost my wife, and I know when the people who are most empathetic are women, and they hug me, and I hug them, and it's different than before. And I think he went through a lot with his son Beau died a few years ago,
and his wife and child before that.
That was 1972.
But still,
yeah, right.
Still, it was. He's a very emotional guy, and yeah. I think he's he is touchy-feely, but with both sex. He puts his arms around men, and he's going through a lot. And I think that comes out with this woman. It was on the back of her head. He put his face in it. I mean, give the guy a break. That's what I'm saying.
So do you think Democratic primary voters will be as charitable as Frank is, Peter Galzanis?
I don't know. I think it underscores, the generational differences.
I think it does,
but. But I agree with Frank. I mean, I think that should, you know, if it's going to play out, it's going to play out. But I mean, you know, at least give him a chance to deal with it out in the open. If in fact he's going to, I mean, I jump in, you know. But I mean, I think, and those things are going to play out during the whole course of the campaign too.
Well, you know, we heard a lot about the Mueller report or the Barr summary of the Mueller report, that state of mind matters, you know, in terms of obstruction of justice. And so does that matter that Biden is, what is he, 76?
I mean, how can we be picking at this guy when the president of the United States is allowed? I mean, it's crazy.
The perception of the woman, obviously this Flores woman was very upset that was running for lieutenant governor. But does the vice president's mindset, if he was trying to be, a nice guy, or if he was trying to grab a quick whatever, you know what I mean?
No, I go back to, what he's emotional. He's
yeah.
in a very emotional state. I know that. I empathize with them. A lot of men, you know, sometimes they give you a hug, you feel like you're going to get a little freeze there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, frostbite. But with women, I just know what he's, you know, they're much more emotional people.
But the issue, I
think he finds a lot of comfort in that.
I have to say, I think all three of you, I don't know where you really are on this, Marjorie. We're going to talk to listeners about it at 12, by the way. I think it's a bigger problem. I think if everybody sat down, I guess I'm mostly talking to Frank, as voters, and said, let me think about this a while. Let's talk about our personal experiences, sorrow we've experienced, etc. It might be different, but everything is so snap fast. Front
agree.
Page of the paper where all three of you used to work, Boston Herald, is Touchy Joe with five photographs. The Drudge Report.
Yeah, but you know where that's coming from.
No, but it's not. But it's not just there. I mean, CNN is surely not a right-wing cable network. They were doing almost nonstop. And when a guy is about to enter a race, assuming he does enter a race, and if you were to stop 100 people on the street and say, what do you know about this guy? My guess is they'd say he was vice president and he touches women. And
in the last few years, particularly with the Me Too movement, which
yeah.
is there are terrible abuses, and thank God that they're coming out. But you know,
well, that's the thing is,
what do you do? How do you delineate? And this is a big problem we're facing. Sorry,
you're not going to change the current atmosphere and the current background. I mean, he's going to have to figure it out and decide whether he wants to, you know, go forward with it. But you're right. It's going to be an issue that is going to be amplified, and if he feels he can handle it and deal with it, then you know. But the reality of today is people are going to see that is something that it's going to weaken him.
A lot of men have to think about it. Look, I came in this room. Marjorie saw me. I gave her a kiss on the cheek, but I said, am I doing the right thing?
Oh, my gosh.
You didn't say a word to me.
I was reading. I did say hello out of there. But can I tell you, I think it was Bernie Sanders. I mean, Elizabeth Warren was pretty tough on him yesterday on Biden and this thing. Bernie Sanders, which I thought was really odd, said, and I'm paraphrasing, well, you know, you shouldn't, should he pull out, should he not run, whatever the question was. Well, a single event should not ruin your career kind of thing. One, it's not a single event. And two, the backdrop for this, which I would argue is just as serious, is his incredibly tin-eared comment in New York last week when he's trying to do a little preventive work on the Anita Hill problem, the failure to call the three corroborating witnesses. His quote is, I wish I could have done something. He was the chair of the Judiciary Committee.
That's a much bigger problem.
But it's sort of part of the.
You're right. Yeah.
And so my sense is if it was a one and done, this thing with Flores, who I'd never heard of before, the right. former assembly person and woman who ran for lieutenant governor unsuccessfully in Nevada, I would agree with you. I think as a part of a pattern of conduct, even if it is there's no malevolence involved, it's just the way he is, and he didn't mean any harm. He, right. As he said in his statement, I didn't mean to do anything inappropriate. I never felt I did. I think the combination of the things is going to make it tougher for him than some may think. In any case, talking to Frank Phillips and Peter Galzinis.
Okay. I hesitate to even ask this question because I've heard this guy's name pronounced so
many
times.
Oh, I want to hear this. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to call him Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
I think that's very close, actually.
Thank you.
That's it.
Okay. So he is doing very well. He's, you know, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's like 37 years old. He's a gay guy. But he seems to be capturing a lot of excitement in this Democratic field.
I think he's, I've seen him on a number of shows. The Morning Joe show a week or two ago, they said that, you know, they got the most response of just about any candidate they'd been on.
He's number three in Iowa after Sanders and Biden. No one even heard of him a month ago.
You know, he seems incredibly natural willing to. He was on with Maher on Friday night and handled that very well. And Maher was kind of pushing against him on a couple of things. But, you know, to me, I think he just may be the sleeper here, you know, that that comes up from back there. I mean, I think he's I'm very, very impressed with him. Very impressed with him.
So what's your sense of the early days of the guy we never heard of till a while
ago? He's very impressive, but he's 37 years old. I think the ultimate question is, with all the Democrat primary voters from the left to the moderates, is that how will he do against Trump? How will he stand up? That'll be the real test that people will have in their minds. Can he stand up there on a platform with Trump? Can Trump make an idiot out of him, or will he be strong enough to
I think to what he can
that?
Do, though, I think, given what I've seen in terms of, and I'm speculating wildly, but given his temperament, I think he'll allow Trump to make an idiot out of himself. I mean, I think the idea of trying to go up against him in Trumpian terms is kind of futile. I mean, he's so over the top, Trump, that in a way, maybe you just let him spit himself out.
You know, one of the interesting things to me is Seth Moulton was on a show yesterday, I don't know which one, saying Jake Tapper at CNN is going to decide in the next 2 weeks. I actually thought a few months ago that in light of the fact that two leaders were 76 and 77 years old, Sanders and Biden at that time, and I guess they still are, that there was clearly a place for a young, different kind of Democrat, particularly since he stood up to the leadership, even though it hurt him with some people, standing up to Pelosi. I think he waited too long. I think the Beto O'Rourke / Buttigieg, if that's
right,
how you say
exactly.
it, entry, a 37 and a 40-something-year-old, while they don't have his military record, needless
Buttigieg
to say.
I think
he's this guy's one. I mean, Moulton, four tours of duty. He's won honors. And I don't mean to disparage anybody's service.
Right.
I'm just saying, but it seems to me his time has passed.
Now Moulton
for this round?
Moulton has put himself in the political wilderness with the Pelosi thing particularly. And, in the leadership in the Congress, Democrat leadership in the Congress, they may be polite about it, but I know firsthand that they're seething about him. And she doesn't forget. And he's closed off his opportunities now. Ed Markey is all over the state, and he'd be a tough challenge. That's one
if he
thing.
Decides to run in a primary.
Yeah, if he ran in a primary against him. And also, so why not try to go out there and do, you may flame out, but you also may strike lightning, go out there and try to sell yourself nationally, because his future in the Congress is very, very low at this point. And his political future here in Massachusetts is nothing.
We're going over the latest headlines from the State House, the White House, with Frank Phillips and Peter Galtinez. We're going to keep talking to them after this brief break. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're tuning in, we're talking politics with the Globe's Frank Phillips, the Herald. Well, they're both emeritus. Whatever they are, they used to be huge stars, the Globe and the Herald.
Now they're all washed up.
Whatever
they
are now.
Has been out.
Yeah.
That's right. So Lori Trahan, who is the 3rd District Congresswoman, she ran on a centerpiece. Transparency was a big deal for her campaign. We now learn, and Andrea Estes has done great reporting on this at the Boston Globe, ex of the Boston Herald, of course, that this watchdog group, this campaign legal center, quote, has reason to believe she materially represented this last-minute infusion of funds, about $200,000, which enabled her to vault from fourth place to victory in this very tight Democratic primary. And Andrea Estes reported over the weekend that Trahan has changed her campaign and personal finance reports 7 times since the election to make it look like she had the money to put into this last-minute transfusion of funds. But it all looks very odd because of different she says her company was worth $1,000 to $15,000, then $15,000 to $50,000, and yet she earned all this money, $300,000 and from this company. The whole thing is kind of a mess, and she hasn't agreed to any interviews, so I'll shut up now.
Well, she just had the thesis is that from
it's
the
her
critics,
husband's money.
It's her husband's money, yeah. And for those who don't understand the federal campaign finance law, the limit for any person other than the candidate, him or herself, even if you're married to the other person, is
$2,700. Does not look good for...
If you get a call from my old
Amen.
Former deskmate, Andrea Estes,
Leave
you're
town.
Cooked. Yeah, you just better hang
well,
up.
Well, you know, the thing I understand, I want to add a couple things to this. She says there was $300,000, her staff person says $300,000 in a joint account. She didn't even disclose the existence of the joint account until after November. Her spokesperson, I would argue this is not very helpful, says the Globe doubts her success as a businesswoman, the implication being this is all sexist reporting.
The last refuge of scandals.
No names of clients disclosed. And in fact, in 2018, not even disclosure that she had paying clients. She won't give an interview to Andrea Estes. We have invited her on Greater Boston, I think, as much as many as a dozen times. She's unavailable. I assume her strategy is she thinks Andrea Estes is going to take a buyout and retire. I mean, at some point, you got to deal with this,
or
right?
That, or that people don't care.
Well, they may not care. I don't know if they care or not.
Well, she only won by, 145
you
votes.
You wrote a ton of campaign finance stuff in state in your day at the... I mean, is this doesn't smell right, does it?
It doesn't, and I've argued strenuously with her... advisors, they're not serving her right if they can't.
You have had these discussions?
Yes, I know the people who are around her, and they've said, oh, the Globe is being unfair. I said, you have not served her well because you have not allowed Andrea to look at the books. Show us the books. Show us where, you know, how she got this money. And that everything, Andrea would walk away if she can prove that it was correct. But they won't, and that's why it's so suspicious.
Can I elaborate on that? Because that is exactly the nail. Estes, I think we did too, asked for the bank records. And the reason, I think what Frank is talking about, if she released the bank records, it would say, where did the income come from?
Exactly.
Out of which she spent whatever it was, $371,000, the loan of $371,000, ultimately spending on ads. No interviews, won't release the bank records. And it seems to me that in many ways, they're digging themselves deeper. It's one of these things where if they had said up front, oops, I took it from a joint account. I thought I took it from a joint account. I took it from my husband. I assume there would have been a fine.
Yeah,
and it would have been the end of the thing.
They could have walked away from it.
But if they're telling the truth, fine. Then I assume you do an interview and release the records. If they're not telling the truth, they're digging themselves deeper
and
deeper.
Well, eventually she's going to have to do that. And she may try to hold out for, you know, because it's an under investigation, she can't do it. But it may be too late at this point. It should be damaged. She'll be politically damaged by this.
You would think that people in the business would know. I mean, given Andrea's name, given the situation, that they would say, oh, this is... You know, I don't want something happen to me that happened to Sal. You know, I mean, you would just think that people would be smart enough to understand that and say, look, deal with her.
And by the way, we should say, Frank said he knows some of the consultants. The consultants I know who are working for are the highest quality, most skilled people who in the business. And so it is amazing to me that they continue to dig a hole. I mean, if you're innocent, produce the records, as you said, Frank, which will prove your innocence. If you're not, you know, fall on your sword and say, I'm willing to pay a fine. I screwed up.
At the beginning.
Exactly. At the beginning. I agree. It's a lot tougher.
Yeah. But one last thing. Obviously, if you ran against her, you think it's pretty upsetting to you and maybe to constituents.
Well, Dan Coe, who lost by 120 votes.
Exactly. And she ran out of transparency. So obviously, she's not being transparent. But if this last infusion of funds, which maybe she shouldn't have had, enabled her to catapult from fourth place to win, I don't know. That's upsetting, isn't it?
It would be if you're with the Go campaign, and a lot of the people around Trahan are feeling this is Coe's attempt to set it right, and the reason he lost, and he should come back, and all that. Coe heatedly denies that, but there are people around Coe who may well have been pointing this out to Andrea. I'd have been asked.
Is there any kind of legal option that he has?
He could leak the stuff.
It's over.
But I mean,
she's
so what?
Elected.
The issue is: are they right on the merits? Are they wrong on the merits?
But there's no legal. Well, there's legal options that she could get fined. There's nothing but a fine on this, a heavy fine.
Yes, yeah, a civil. Yeah.
Well,
action.
Except Andrea's first piece, and I want to echo what Marjorie said. She is a brilliant reporter, and these are incredible.
She's a great reporter.
Last paragraph of the first of two pieces she's written. The first one was on March 3rd. Second one over the weekend, I think it was Saturday or Sunday. But if there appears to be intent to shield the source of funds, intent rather than just a mistake, quote, that's the kind of case if the FEC uncovered the evidence, they would refer to the public integrity section of the Justice Department, says this D.C. lawyer, Brett Capital, who specializes in political law.
Trahan can take comfort in the FEC is totally dysfunctional.
That's a very...
they don't conduct investigations.
That's a hell of a thing to hang your hat on, isn't it?
They collect papers and reports. And that's
I wasn't in the third CD, and we didn't really cover it much here or on television because there were so many candidates. But I've only interviewed her once. She is really an impressive person, at least from my 1 10-minute. The fact that they have bungled this so incredibly poorly is like...
She's politically experienced, too. She goes way back.
She has a Mann connection. Does she work for Marty Mann?
Her husband is one of Marty Mann's closest friends.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And they all grew up in South Lowell.
I see.
Okay, while we're on ethics discussions, let's get back to this case of Ken Brissett, Tim Sullivan, these two guys that work for Mayor Marty Walsh. They were charged with extortion. This was this case back in 2014, this Boston Calling Music Festival, when they, Brissett and Sullivan, were accused of strong-arming promoters of the show so they could get some union jobs that weren't needed for people that supported the mayor. Judge throughout the case last year said that prosecutors have to prove that both of them had personally benefited from alleged extortion. Now the case is back in play, and
A higher court reinstated the thing.
That's right. So the case is back in play, and Adrian Walker's got a good piece in the Globe saying that he doesn't think they're going to get convicted, but he doesn't think they should be in prison or anything like that. But he doesn't think they should be at City Hall either. What do you think, Frank?
I think it's a real shame. Everybody, I don't know the other fellow, but Tim Sullivan is a highly respected guy, and people like him. He's a good person. And he was doing what all union people do, help union his colleagues, his fellow union members. And he didn't personally benefit from this. I've always been astounded that they brought a prosecution against him. He didn't personally benefit. And I think that should be the litmus test. Either him or anybody close to him, a brother, a sister, brother-in-law, a family member. But he was helping fellow union people to get a job. And
the appellate court says that's not a necessary element of the crime, that you don't have to personally benefit. Now, most legal experts agree it's a fine line kind of thing. But that's why they... what I had forgotten until I read Adrian's piece, and
Jack
shame
and
on
Ryan.
Us. No, is that, well, I, that too. They've been on the payroll this whole time. Even when they were on administrative leave, they've been on the payroll for a couple of years. I've known Tim Sullivan from a long time, from his labor days, and I agree, a decent person. I did a police walk with Ken Brissett. I didn't even know it was him prior to all this happening, and really warm, decent guy, too. But it is odd that they've been on the payroll, I assume out of compassion on Walsh's part. I don't know
They haven't been convicted.
But I understand that, but when you're charged with pretty serious stuff, how often do you get to stay home and get paid?
Well, Walsh is a union guy, that's a brotherhood. So I'm not surprised.
But at the same time, I just mentioned this because at the same time, the case against Jack O'Brien was thrown out because he didn't receive anything from personal value. And if people recall, I don't know if you did stories on this the probation department scandal, where it was just people were hiring their brother-in-laws, their unqualified father-in-law. They were hiring people with very weird records.
Far worse scandal than
far worse scandal. Yeah. But he was convicted, and then a judge overturned that case too for the reason that O'Brien never received anything of personal value. So should that be the litmus test, whether you receive something of personal value? I don't know.
I think so. I mean, in the O'Brien case, as you say, it was a mess.
It was a mess, but he got off
because of it. Yeah,
should he have gotten off?
Well, I can't make that judgment.
Okay. All right. My cousin got screwed in that case, so I feel very personally about the whole thing. Let's ask another.
You Irish.
The
That's
cousin
right.
was passed over.
She for was. A, she an was. She was for
and
years.
That she deserved, and it's true.
But let's talk about another ethical issue and what you guys think about this. Walsh again. He spent nearly $900,000 on this so-called boutique fundraising consulting firm, where his longtime girlfriend Lori Higgins works, and that $900,000 has accounted for more than half the company's political business. Is that small potatoes, or is that something we should be worried about?
That's very sketchy, very sketchy, and he should not have that arrangement at all. He's raising a lot of political funds that are going to pay her salary. And at first it looked, okay, innocuous. It wasn't that much. Now it... But my colleague, Matt Stout.
Matt Stout, another guy from the Herald.
Yeah, that's, right. That's, right.
That's right.
We're all from the Herald.
We're all from the Herald, including you, Frank Phillips.
Right. We used to be a feeder.
That's right.
It was always easy because they used to hire Ivy Leaguers from the Globe. And as they said in Lowell,
you came from the Harvard Herald at one point, Frank. You
know? Oh, very good. I like that.
He went to Harvard. He's not very smart.
So are you troubled? Anyway. Marjorie and Frank are
really troubled. I think it's a, you know, keep peace at home. I'm kind of wondering. I mean, you know,
that means you don't
it's a little bit
question,
more than a
right?
coincidence. Well, I mean, you know.
It's not illegal. There's no right. It doesn't. It's not illegal.
And I'm sure
well, it's grown.
No, go ahead. I'm sure.
It's grown. I think what has astounded people, we all knew this, we wrote about it, but what Matt found out in the last couple of weeks is that it really grew exponentially after his reelection. And, you know, what's going on here? It just it doesn't make sense. Compared to the fees that that firm, Larry Bozzio's firm, has charged other political campaign committees is way above what other firms have.
Well, you know, which would also, when you look at this just as a layperson, that I remember we had stories about her when she was a waitress at that Boston restaurant, the one on Dorchester, 224,
I think
whatever it is.
On Boston
and
Street.
And so obviously, you know, she now doesn't need to waitress anymore.
But what's your point?
Well, I mean, I mean,
everybody says, I've only met her, but
she's
everybody
a
says
she's lovely.
No, I don't care about lovely. Everybody says she's really skillful.
Right.
The other clients of this firm in Matt Stown's piece
say
she does really good
Take
work.
Take the skills somewhere else.
I think it, to the average person, I could be mistaken, but it looks odd when your girlfriend is profiting from.
I think the mayor's made a mistake here, and he should rectify it. And. It just doesn't look good.
Okay, so you guys have been outraged about one thing or another. Here's what I'm outraged about. There's an editorial in the Globe, which I think is perfect. I think it was in this morning's paper, about these Wynn hearings. The hearings into whether or not the whatever the new Wynn is post Steve, sexual misconduct man himself, no longer with the company. Should they keep the license for a casino that is tentatively scheduled to open just, what, 2 months from now, in June, right. It is. And there are a couple of things. One, the editorial today focuses on a couple. One, that the original hearing was streamed on the website of the Gaming Commission. This one is not. The original results of the original investigation that found them suitable was immediately put on the website. This one will not be, even though I assume it will be public at one point. And the third piece they reflect on that we've discussed with the Attorney General on Friday, we discussed it with her 2 months in a row, actually, with Shirley Leung and others, is the Gaming Commission allowed its staff, directed its lawyers to negotiate a settlement with Wynn's lawyers in Nevada so that some of the report could be redacted. So we have the Gaming Commission making a decision on whether or not Wynn, or again, whatever the new entity is, will still be found suitable and allowed to open this multi-billion-dollar business enterprise without the full set of relevant facts, nor will the public. So the public won't have it streamed, the public won't see the report online, and the Gaming Commission itself is making a decision based upon incomplete information. I mean, does that not smell horrible, Peter Galzinis?
It does. It does. But, I mean, I kind of wonder whether they think that even with the baggage that he has you know, he is, or that label is more impressive than them trying to find somebody else.
But how can you make a decision on a suitability when you don't know what you don't know? When you've allowed your lawyers to negotiate for redactions that may be, I would assume whatever Wynn wants redacted by definition is probably the most damaging part of the report, right? He says it's attorney-client stuff.
You're right,
that's
Jim.
A problem, right?
You're right, Jim. This is one of the few outrages that I agree with you with. But it is. It's terrible. I don't know how they got away with it, and I would think maybe the attorney general should subpoena the records and see exactly what you're doing here. And if they can make a case to somebody else, a third party, that this was necessary, maybe that would be one way to deal with it.
Well, by the way, to her credit, I should say, a month ago, she said to us, the Attorney General, something like, you know, building schmilding. It wasn't that disrespectful. Right. The issue is, are they suitable and did essentially the misconduct of Wynn, was it known by people still in positions of power, in which case the building is secondary? And secondly, she said to us this past Friday, Frank, exactly what you just said, we're watching this closely, and if we feel there's any, she didn't use the word impropriety, whatever, any problem, we will review this thing. So I think she's on top of it, and I think it's good. You know, before you go, a little bit, talking to Frank Phillips here, a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk to Joe Matthew, our colleague, who along with Karen Marshall, his colleague, just got back from a weekend in Havana. You were there, too. Can you explain to people why you were and what went on?
Oh, God. Life begins in the sea. Jenny and I, my wife, who passed away this summer very suddenly in a drowning accident, but about 18 years ago, 2001, we started a project in Cuba based on her, and it had to do with the Hemingway Museum there, where Hemingway spent most of his life. People don't realize it, and there were a lot of things left behind in the house. Cubans weren't, you could see, were with holding it together with baling wire and chewing gum. And a lot of the documents were, it was an archival emergency, according to scholars up here, and they were holding on to it. And we were able to, through the help of Representative Jim McGovern, who went directly to Fidel Castro, and we got a project going, first to archive the papers, digitalize them, and get them up here at the Kennedy Library with the Hemingway collection. Then we took on the house with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. They're preserving the house. It was falling out. They reconstruct almost the whole house. It's a beautiful villa. And a 9,000-book library that EMC came in and helped us do that. And then we bought the final thing was a conservatory laboratory. It was the first North American building built in Cuba since the revolution. And Jenny really left headed up the effort with her foundation with a lot of very distinguished people on it. And they had a big ceremony down there to open up this. And we took it down a delegation. I took my children, my two children, grown children, my grandson and granddaughter down there to see what their grandmother did. And it was very emotional. We went in, and a wing of the building is named after Jenny Phillips.
Didn't you tell me, we were talking about union guys strong-arming, didn't you tell me that your wife strong-armed the Cubans into letting her into that place where a lot of these archival Hemingway papers were?
It was a struggle. Even when Fidel agreed and sent the word down that to the cultural minister to cooperate, the Cubans, who have been preyed upon in all aspects by North Americans and look upon North Americans with great suspicion, the Cubans at the level that we were dealing with were very hesitant, and we had to build a lot of trust over. And we were finally let in as one of the first few of North Americans into the basement where all these documents, including letters, they all started with asking for letters about her grandfather, Maxwell Perkins, the great editor of Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Perkins, and all those people, Hemingway and Wolfe, that we wanted to see if there are any letters. They said there are letters there, but you can't see them. Being Jenny's husband for the last 50 years, I don't know. You don't get between something she wants. I've been there, and it's a bad place to be. She made that all happen. As I say, I carried the bags, hailed the taxis, and had a good ride with her.
That's great. Congratulations.
Well,
to you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a great story, Frank. And thank you very much, both of you, for coming in. Frank Phillips is the former State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Peter Galsinis is columnist emeritus for the Boston Herald. Frank and Peter, thank you again. Coming up, Deal or No Deal, WGBH news analyst Charlie Sennett joins us to talk about the latest on Brexit and what it means for Theresa May. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. Last Wednesday, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen signed what she called a first-of-its-kind regional compact with Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to work together on the migration crisis. Today, Trump is planning to cut aid to all three of those countries. But is that a self-defeating problem if aid actually keeps people in Central America from migrating? That's not how Mick Mulvaney, Trump's acting chief of staff, sees it.
Look, there's a lot of good ways to help solve this problem. Congress could do it, but they're not going to. Mexico could help us do it. They need to do a little bit more. Honduras could do more. Nicaragua could do more. El Salvador could do more. And if we're going to give these countries hundreds of millions of dollars, we would like them to do more. That is not an unreasonable position.
Joining us for his take on this, the latest on Brexit and other global headlines, is Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH. We also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hello, Charlie Sennett.
Hi, Jim. I'm Marjorie.
Good to see you, Charlie Sennett. Well, is Mulvaney being unreasonable? I mean, you could argue that we have given millions of dollars to these countries over many years to alleviate poverty, to help the economy, and it's not helped.
I think it's understandable. It's human to think, like, you're not doing enough. We're going to punish you. The problem is the $500 million in aid goes to alleviate the poverty that's creating those who feel desperate enough to take on an arduous and dangerous journey to try to come to America. So it's not the right solution. I mean, certainly we're all frustrated that this flow of immigrants is just pounding down on the border, and it's a deep crisis. I think that the Democrats are doing a real disservice to finding a solution by trying to say there's no crisis. They were wrong. There's a problem at the border. The numbers are rising. We have to deal with it, and it's real. But you don't go to the core of the problem, which is poverty, and say we're going to cut all the aid to the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that serve you and serve poverty programs in these countries where it's coming from. That's just working against yourself, I think.
You've all seen the Chiron, the thing at the bottom of the screen on Fox News over the weekend. I'll read it. Trump cuts U.S. aid to three Mexican countries.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, it is almost... I mean, it's almost, you had to
assume.
Well,
they did apologize, didn't they?
Well, I know, but I mean, oh my God, to three Mexican countries. Well, you say the Democrats are doing a disservice by suggesting it's not a crisis. I'm not sure they haven't suggested a crisis. They're just saying the wall's not the answer. But Trump has a new answer. He is threatened, and he says he's serious over the weekend or maybe Friday, I can't remember what day, to say we're going to shut down the border. And that means not just migration. It means business. Mexico's got to do more, too. They're not doing it. End of discussion. I mean,
I think Democrats were saying that there wasn't a crisis or that Trump's exaggerating it. And then all, you know, I think there was a kind of a framing of the argument there where the Democrats wanted to soft pedal it. I think they should step back and realize there's a real issue here. Closing the border, as Trump is proposing, you want to create a crisis, close the border. That will devastate the American auto industry. It'll devastate agriculture. You'll have literally an extraordinary economic impact on our own country and in Mexico overnight, alienate our ally to the border. And I think you really could foster and deepen a crisis. And, you know, I think this presidency thrives on crisis. I think they want crisis. I can't help but think it's always the distraction. It's always something new. And every time we get closer to some reckoning with this presidency, there's some new crisis. And I think we should be sophisticated in how we approach this one. To close the border is crazy. If you ask any economist, if you ask anyone outside of the partisan politics of this, the economic impact that will have is extraordinary.
Well, yeah, you said he creates a crisis whenever he needs a diversion. I mean, I totally agree with that, even though one would argue after his... the Mueller report, at least via Barr, you would think he'd want to focus on that. But my sense with this, in light of the fact that I haven't heard any sane people say that either of these behaviors, either the cutting of aid to the three Mexican countries, as Fox News called them, or shutting the border, will achieve any desired result, even results that Trump has, it's because the single best campaign issue for him in 2016, other than maybe I'm the great disruptor, is build the wall, is stop immigration, don't let any Muslims in the country, whatever. I mean, this is obviously not a Muslim issue, but he's returning to his presidential political roots, right?
Fear sells. Yeah. Speak to the base. Tell them there's a horde of immigrants coming over the border that we have to stop, and we have to bring our soldiers to the border. That works. That, sadly, I think people get confused. They don't listen to the issues carefully. They don't parse them out. Democrats do a terrible job, I think, presenting their point of view. I feel like there's a lot of fingers we can point in all kinds of different directions. But one of the sad truths of the time we live in right now is that the issue of immigration, which is one that really does need sane reform, is getting so balkanized and such a partisan issue that we can't think straight about it. And in the vacuum of rational thought, fear floods the zone. And when fear comes in, that's when you have what I would call populist authoritarianism, this rising sense of the fear of the other that leads countries toward authoritarian governments. This is happening everywhere. And you could even trace this back to some extent, even to the Brexit mess in the UK. You could say
that's going well, don't you think, so far?
That's so really well. But the I wrote a column last week that was basically saying we have these two cataclysms. One called Trump and one called Brexit. And I don't care where you come down, if you're in favor of Trump or you're against him,
totally,
or if you're
agree.
In favor of Brexit or you're against it, you would undeniably have to say they have created more bitter divisions in our respective countries than any time in a generation. And therefore, they are cataclysms. They are eruptions on the surface of our body politic on both sides of the pond. And I think they're coming from this same nativist fear.
Or the Russians. Or the Russians.
And exactly, Marjorie. They are literally, what do they have in common?
Yeah.
That crooked smile by Vladimir Putin, that he's enjoying this and watching our countries grow internally divided and dysfunctional. And we need to shift the debate now and say, hey, let's put aside a lot of the partisan aspects here and realize we have one big thing we need to focus on, which is Russia meddled in both the Brexit vote and in favor of Trump in our last presidential election. What are we doing to say, how did that happen? How do we make sure it never happens again? Where are the Democrats on that? Never mind, where's Trump? We know he's been nowhere.
Right.
Where are the Democrats on that?
What do you mean, where are the Democrats? I mean, they've been saying all along, in fact, Democratic congressperson we've interviewed since the 17 intelligence agencies spoke, Marjorie's question has always been, are we doing anything about, and remember, they didn't control the House at that point. They've been screaming bloody murder. Our government is not, apparently, doesn't care. But I want to stay on Brexit just for a second.
Okay.
You mentioned two parallels. You know, one, the Russian influence.
Yep.
Two, the nativist impulse.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we had Elizabeth McGovern, the great actress here on radio and television last week. And by the way, to say she is passionate about this issue, she's a dual citizen. She voted to remain. And she is a strong advocate. You'll love this, Charlie. For what? A second referendum.
Yay.
And she made the point.
It actually should be called Jim's referendum.
I would say so. Jexit, we can call it. But, you know, she made the point, I think, on television we were talking about. Just like, Marjorie, you say all the time, Donald Trump ran as a progressive, you know.
A populist.
Tax cuts for the middle class,
right.
All this sort of stuff. I was reading just last week, and it refreshed my memory. The primary promise that convinced so many people is whatever it is, the £350 million or whatever the figure is, the UK was contributing to the EU. Every pound was going to be redirected to the National Health Service. And that's a total fraud, too. So, I mean, the parallels are epic. It is really amazing.
And one last thing about Brexit before you answer, Charlie, is I was reading my favorite podcast, listening to my favorite podcast of the Daily this morning, and poor Theresa May, they described her as the worst retail politician in history, and talking about how she'd go everywhere and say, Brexit means Brexit. Brexit means Brexit.
Right.
It became this meaningless model. What the heck does that mean? So, yes, the votes come closer and closer and closer to passing.
But she can't get it done.
She can't get it done.
You know how I sometimes say, remember I told you about this and that, and I always like to say how right I am? Remember how wrong I was on Theresa May? I thought because of her background as a real precise politician who understands economics, I thought she would do something miraculous, which is navigate this forward in a way that it worked. I was wrong. I liked
her too. I guess she's terrible.
Three times she's brought her proposal before Parliament. Three times it's been rejected. And I was laughing very hard when I heard a British commentator comparing Theresa May to the knight in Monty Python's Holy Grail having his limbs chopped off and coming back for more. You know, that it's kind of a cruel comparison, but it really made me laugh when I heard
it.
Look, she's in deep trouble. Her reign as prime minister is effectively over.
Well, she said she'll quit if they approve some, right?
Right.
Right. So what is – we ask you every single week, what is going to happen here?
So every time you guys ask me and I leave this studio feeling like a total loser for not having an answer, I go in and tune into the BBC where people like Andrew Marr, who cover politics every day inside Parliament, say we have no idea what's going to happen.
Is that really so?
I really think that this is I don't know what is going to happen. I know that – you know, we have a situation where it's something's got to happen pretty soon, and a couple things are looking possible, and one of them is a hard Brexit. And that is something that I think...
Meaning a no-deal kind of, no deal, don't know, right, just it ends.
No deal, it ends. There's chaos. There is, like, you know, talk about closing the border in Mexico. I mean, this would be equal levels of chaos for the British economy. But I feel like... we're going to just have to hold on to our hats and see where this goes. And one of the things, because this is Boston and because so many of your listeners care a lot about the Good Friday Peace Agreement in Ireland, it's kind of worth talking about one of the real fault lines that runs through what will happen if there is this no deal Brexit.
Well, explain
or the
that. We
Brexit.
Discussed that. What's the name of the guy from the New Yorker who
Patrick
wrote that great
O'Keefe.
Book?
Patrick Fenton O'Keefe.
Yeah, oh my God.
Brandon
wrote that
O'Keefe.
Book.
Wrote that great book.
You guys
book.
Had him.
We
had him a couple of weeks ago. He was
terrific.
Great.
He's
amazing.
Yeah. He really is.
But could you explain what the implications are between North and South?
Yeah,
again,
absolutely.
If people
so everyone
that.
Who.
Patrick Radden. Thank you.
Radden
very much.
O'Keefe.
Thank
you very much.
Our listeners here.
O'Keefe. Is it O'Keefe?
We got Patrick right. So I don't know. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think our listeners know about the 1998 Good Friday Agreement that ended 30 years of struggles in Northern Ireland where, you know, thousands of people were killed in relentless violence, sectarian violence, right? That took a long time to pull off. It's probably one of Bill Clinton's greatest accomplishments as president was to usher forward the Good Friday Agreement. That hasn't been in place that long. That if we think all of the animosity built up between Catholics and Protestants, between those who believe in the Republican ideals of a Sinn Féin vision of one Ireland versus those who are loyal to the Crown and loyal to their British heritage in Northern Ireland, we're crazy because they're not over. And there's evidence of it. Every time you go into Northern Ireland, you see what are called the peace walls, these enormous walls that separate neighborhoods that still don't have much love for each other, if not contempt, and lots of scar tissue. Like, there are still cases that need to be gone through the courts about murders and about people who are missing. This is nowhere near over. They've never had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They've never really worked through the hard issues. But what they have done is found a power-sharing agreement for the way they will run Northern Ireland, the six counties of Northern Ireland that are under the UK. And they have been able to say, we've made great progress. But if you try to reimpose a hard border and you take down those gun towers where the British soldiers used to look down on Catholic Irish neighborhoods along the border and the fear that created and the animosity that created and the violence that created... Look, I hope it never returns, and I don't think it will, actually. I really believe it won't. But we're crazy not to be thinking about the Brexit agreement without factoring in the possibility that if you pull the rug out from under the Good Friday Agreement, you could have a return to a cycle of violence in Northern Ireland.
Charlie, I don't know what to think about NATO because this is not my area of expertise, but a great piece in The Nation argues that NATO's celebrating its 70th birthday this week.
Mm-hmm.
And this piece basically argues that we are screwing it up big time in NATO by adding more and more nations, pushing through more Eastern countries.
It's not an anti-Trump thing, we should say.
It is not. Yeah. No, it is not an anti-Trump thing at all. And they talk about how, you know, we've embraced countries like Turkey, which has not exactly been holding up Western values and democratic values. They have this anecdote in here. They talk about one of NATO's first major post-Cold War missions, a 78-day aerial bombing of Serbia, which nearly ended in disaster when NATO Supreme Commander and one-time presidential candidate Wesley Clark ordered British General Mike Jackson, commander of NATO's troops in Kosovo, to retake the airfield in Pristina, the capital, from the Russians by force. And then the British guy apparently said to Wesley Clark, I'm not going to start the Third World War for you, and that was the end of that. But the point of it is that we have antagonized Russia needlessly by this continuing expansion. and we don't have that much to celebrate in NATO. So I don't know.
We have 90 seconds, by the way.
Okay, sorry. I was there in Kosovo covering that moment in time when they had to decide whether or not to take the airport. And I will never forget seeing the Russian soldiers with those blue-striped shirts underneath their army uniforms standing there and watching these NATO troops coming in. You're thinking, oh, my God, this is a fault line like we've just never seen or imagined. And that was an error. And NATO has expanded beyond its original intentions. And Russia does feel threatened by it. And it has a lot to do with why Putin pushes back on Russian greatness and sees this guy in the White House who's buying everything he's saying.
Right.
And why he's so elated, why he smiles. But I also would say, remember, NATO also stopped Serbian aggression and the unbelievable forces of ethnic cleansing that were going on in Kosovo.
It was horrible. We just saw the frontline piece.
It was a proud moment, too, when Clinton descended into Kosovo, into one of those refugee camps, and they said, hey, we're here and we're going to liberate Pristina from Serbian forces. We're not going to allow what happened in the Balkans many years ago when we didn't act fast enough and there was even more killing than there already had been. And I feel like as a reporter who back then for the Boston Globe was among a team of reporters on the ground covering that, it's both ways. That was one of NATO's proud moments, but it was also a really perilous moment
so
where the overreach was
reform
there.
Reform or what?
I think NATO needs to stay focused on who it is and what it does. And I do think we have a lot to celebrate in 70 years of the mission of NATO to talk about how alliances build strength and reduce violence in the world. That's true. NATO's proven that over 70 years, and we can't lose sight of that. We also shouldn't be, you know, hands up, we're great, we're fine. No, NATO needs attention. NATO needs to contour to the reality of today. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that April 4th, 1949, when it was created, was a big and important moment for peace in the world.
Charlie Sennett, thank
you
very
much. Good to see you, Charlie. By the way, the name of that brilliant frontline documentary we talked about last week is called The Trial of Ratko Mladic.
It was amazing.
It was incredible.
Frontline at its best.
Absolutely. Oh, it was fantastic. Charlie, thank you very much. Charlie joins us every week. He's a news analyst at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you about Joe Biden. Is he too touchy-feely for 2020? This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, in the era of Me Too, how Joe can you go in 2019, or Joe Biden's, as he calls them, expressions of affection, a problem. There's the shoulder rubs, the kisses, the hugs, the countless times he's whispered something in women's ears. He doesn't see anything wrong with it. At noon, we'll open the lines and ask you, do you? Then TV Bob Thompson joins us for his take on the final season of Veep, Jordan Peele's reboot of The Twilight Zone, and what's next for One Day at a Time, now that Netflix has nixed it.
For 7 weeks, Carolyn Beeler, the environment reporter for The World, was aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer research vessel on an Antarctica voyage to study the melting of Thwaites Glacier. Now that she's back, she'll join us for a recap. We'll find out what she learned about the acceleration of climate change and if she's finally had that big salad she's been dreaming of. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Good afternoon, actually.
Good afternoon, excuse me.
Good afternoon to you, too. It's close enough. Because it was morning like 7 minutes ago. Is that what you're saying? Is that
exactly,
what you're trying to say?
Exactly.
Fine, okay.
Could I say it was April Fool's?
No, you can't. Nice try. For Joe Biden, being physical, being touchy, folksy, was part of his charm, a political style that didn't raise a whole lot of eyebrows during his tenure as vice president or as a senator for decades. Though there is a 2015 video, I assume most of you have seen it, on YouTube called Creepy Joe Compilation. It's about 3 minutes of Joe Biden
nuzzling women, rubbing their shoulders, kissing them, hugging them, hand around their torsos. But today, with social norms changing quickly, particularly in the era of Me Too, is this hands-on approach hands down wrong? In a recent piece for New York Magazine, you all know about her, former Assemblywoman Lucy Flores from Nevada, wrote about the time Joe Biden, she was running for lieutenant governor, smelled her hair, planted a slow kiss on the back of her head. The piece is called An Awkward Kiss Changed How I Saw Joe Biden. We're opening the lines asking you if these close encounters change how you see him. 877-301-8970. With Biden on the verge of announcing, we believe, his presidential runner, his so-called expressions of affection a problem, from Anita Hill to Lucy Flores. We'll talk about Hill in a minute. Is his way with women a deal breaker for you, or is he just the person of another generation? And we should put it in some context. The number is 877-301-8970. What's your sense?
Well, you know, it's a problem. I mean, you want to differentiate. It's not like he grabbed somebody's rear end and squeezed it, or stuck his tongue down somebody's throat.
Or worse, as the president candidate once said,
exactly,
on Access Hollywood.
Well, the president has been accused of sticking his tongue down people's
That's
throats
a good
and
point, yeah.
pushing them against walls and all those kinds of things by almost 20 women and looking at teenage beauty pageant contestants when they're changing their clothes. So his stuff is really over the top. But it is a problem because when you saw this woman Flores on television, she talked about how uncomfortable it made her feel, that he seemed to be smelling her hair and kissing the back of her head, a long kiss. It's a problem. I think Joe Biden's problems go much further than this, but this kind of adds on to his gaffometer. If you go online and look at the mistakes he's made last week, the thing he said about Anita Hill.
Can we get to that in a second? Can
yep.
we stay on? Well, I want to play in his comments about Anita Hill, but first, since you mentioned her, here is Lucy Flores, the woman, the former assemblywoman, on CNN describing how she reacted when then Vice President Biden, she says, touched her inappropriately at that rally.
It was shocking because you don't expect that kind of intimate behavior. You don't expect that kind of intimacy from someone so powerful and someone who you just have no relationship whatsoever to touch you and to feel you and to be so close to you in that way. So I frankly just didn't even know how to react. I was just shocked. I felt powerless. I felt like I couldn't move. I just didn't even know how to process it.
And you mentioned this is on top of what we've known for a long time, is that he was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the Anita Hill hearings. As we discussed with all of you last week, he decided that three witnesses who would have corroborated her testimony and maybe changed history should not testify, which makes part of this quote even more surreal. Here's Biden in New York City, I think it was last Tuesday, saying Anita Hill paid a terrible price during her hearing, and then his response to that.
We knew a lot less about the extent of harassment back then, over 30 years ago, but she paid a terrible price. She was abused through the hearing. She was taken advantage of. Her reputation was attacked. I wish I could have done something. I opposed Clarence Thomas' nomination. I voted against him, but I also realized there was a real and perceived problem the committee faced. There were a bunch of white guys.
It wasn't just that they were a bunch of white guys. As we said last week, when you say, I wish I could have done something, you were chair of the committee.
He was in charge.
You should have allowed the three women or one woman to be called so that it was not he said, she said.
Plus, it was not over 30 years ago. He's making it sound like it was really ancient history.
Were you at the hearings, by the way?
I was.
You were.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like physically? What was it like being there?
Well, I was sitting on the floor. That's how crowded it was. I was sitting on the floor in the back.
In the hearing room.
Yes. But wow. It made you cringe because you're listening to these guys. And the picture of this very dignified African-American woman with her mother and father there listening to Orrin Hatch talk about pubic hairs on Coke cans and whether she, you know, had some kind of sex problem, that she made up these wild stories, and whether she put pubic hairs inside people's law books so that when they'd open them up. I mean, it was nauseating, and she was so dignified. Mm-hmm. I 100% believed her. And the reason I believed her is because these kind of things happen pretty much, not necessarily pubic hairs on Coke cans, but these kind of things happen in the office in those days all the time, and no one really thought it was a problem. And I think Joe Biden, one of the problems for him is that he does look like he's just too old and kind of out of it, that he didn't realize then, okay, maybe you could give him a little bit of a pass. But it's 2019. You know, you can't be... It's a problem.
You know what's a problem also? We are a problem. At least I am a problem. You and I, through the years... By the way, I admire Joe Biden in a lot of ways. I should be clear. I told you I spent an hour interviewing him once, a full hour at NECN. It was really impressive, really smart, about 17, 18 years ago. I can't remember what it was. I think it was one of the times he's running for president. But our memories are so short. This Flores thing has caused all of us to say, aha, I knew about all these videos before. I've seen the video 1,000 times.
The one
I've seen
with a teenage girl.
Well, that's a real
very
problem.
Very upsetting.
Also, even though she said she was fine with it, Carter's Secretary of Defense wife with his hands standing close behind her, with his hands on his shoulders. You know, we were talking to Frank Phillips and Peter Galsinis about this, but what his intentions were. Frankly, his intentions are secondary to me when you're a smart person. The question is, how is your behavior received by somebody who didn't ask for it? And one should be sensitive to the fact that, that even if you intended there to be no harm, in fact, intended it to be warm and reassuring and some positive adjectives, that maybe you should say to the woman, if you're going to do it, is it okay? Or maybe don't even ask when you're the vice president of the United States. So I think
shaking your hand is fine.
I think it's plenty. I agree. I think that's plenty. I think it's a more serious problem. I frankly think the Anita Hill thing has far greater potential to haunt him, even though it's not visually as arresting as some of these encounters of a close kind.
Well, it's making it sound like he was some kind of unwitting bystander, that he wished he could have done more.
He
shut down the hearings, and now we have Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court for all these years making a lot of ridiculous rulings. And we talked about last week how he's trying
to
take away people's ability to have a lawyer if they're a poor person accused of even a capital crime. Mm-hmm. So I hope he doesn't run. You know, Paul just emailed and sent this picture of Matt Men underneath, which he says, yep, times change. We all remember Mad Men was a TV show where, you know, everybody was trying to bet all the secretaries over these three martini lunches during the 1960s.
I think it's a problem, and I think it's a legitimate issue, even though I admire much of his politics. I think it's a serious problem, and those who are criticizing him. By the way, you know who's been the most overt is Elizabeth Warren. A lot of the candidates have been dancing around this thing. What do you have it in front of you?
She said, I believe Lucy Flores and Joe Biden needs to give an answer, Warren said on Saturday, adding that it was up to the Democratic voters whether to support someone in such a position. And Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar said this Sunday on ABC News this week that she had no reason not to believe Flores.
You know, here, just one last thing, and then we'll take your calls. In the statement from Joe Biden, originally I think there was a campaign statement that he put one out, I think it was yesterday. In my many years on the campaign trail and in public life, I've offered countless handshakes, hugs, expressions of affection, support, and comfort. Not once, never did I believe I acted inappropriately. But this is the line that is a reflection of the times. If it is suggested I did so, which it is, I will listen respectfully. It was never my intention. I mean, talk about a change where you're running for president, you're leading in the polls, you're denying something, but you know that it is necessary, as it always should have been, but wasn't, to say that I will listen respectfully. So we want to know what your reaction is to the Flores thing, and I'm sure you've all seen the videos, to the comments about the Anita Hill hearings. And if you think these are survivable, and should they be survivable, is it just one small piece of a man who wants to be president? Or is it, say, more about him, enough about him, that he shouldn't be there? Beth, you're in Newport. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I really believe Joe is a new. He's a cute meme that has really given him a lot of momentum. He's made a very public apology regarding Anita Hill, but I'm interested in knowing, did he make a private apology to Anita Hill?
Oh, that's a good question.
I don't believe the answer is yes. And could one of you guys check this? But I think several months ago, Anita Hill did write somewhere that she was not satisfied with. Well, I shouldn't say this. One of our coworkers will find out exactly, but I don't believe there's been a direct apology. But let's assume there was, Beth. Would that be enough for you?
No, because he's also trying to manipulate us by utilizing the potential of Stacey Abrams running as his vice presidential candidate.
Well, she said no.
Is
a no. She said no.
I know that, but he was floating that.
Yep, he was.
Stacey is too smart to be his Anita Hill apology.
Well, I think you said it pretty well, Beth. Thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970. You know, he's not even in the race yet. Talk about a hell of a...
I hope he doesn't.
He's on an apology. Well, I have a feeling it may cause him not to. I mean, this is pretty serious stuff.
I mean, there's other things. We forget, you know, the long history of Joe Biden. Joe Biden, when he's ramming back with Michael Dukakis, ran, got in trouble for stealing a speech from somebody. He's gotten in trouble many times for these gaffes. You know, they weren't... I mean, I make gaffes all the time, so I don't want to criticize him for the gaffes. But if you go online, there's like the gaffe, you know, the gaffathon of Joe Biden, including remember the time he told the guy to stand up and take a bow.
Well, that's not.
It's not.
It was a person in a wheelchair.
Yes,
and,
it was
and
not
a rally.
There was no ill intent. It was a mistake, and he made a joke about it. He made a remark about Indians from India. You know, there's a lot of things that he said that make him seem a little bit. Kind of goofy.
Here's Beth's answer to Beth's question from Vox a couple of days ago. Thank you, you guys in there. As of last fall, Hill, as in Anita Hill, said she had not received a direct apology from Biden and that the statute of limitations had run out. Those are her words, not my characterization.
He also got in trouble when he called Barack Obama the first clean and articulate guy that was running for president of the United States, too, which didn't go over that well.
Well, obviously, it didn't upset Barack Obama much because he picked him to be his vice presidential nominee, right?
Exactly. Well, and they became very close.
Oh, they did become very close. 877-301-8970. Kate in Somerville, hi.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm a big Joe Biden fan, and I'm grossed out.
Why?
It's trivializing, it's sexualizing to come up on her from behind. From behind. She's preparing to be on stage. She's a professional politician. And he's totally derailing her train of thought and impeding her from concentrating on getting ready.
Yeah.
That's disgusting. That's entitled. It's proprietary. It means he thinks he has the ability and the... obviously, the wherewithal to touch anyone he wants, anywhere he wants, break up their train of thought. They're not important to him. He thinks he's the one who's important. I'm really offended by the fossils you had on at 11 a.m. who just dismissed this.
Fossils.
As if they would want everybody to come in from behind and sniff their hair and kiss the backs of their heads.
Kate,
yeah.
That was a perfect call. And by the way, I'm so glad you added the sniff thing. We've mentioned coming up from behind and kissing her on top of the head. She also says, as Kate just mentioned, that he smelled her hair. I mean, talk about creepy. It is really creepy.
Well,
Kate,
I
that was a great call.
Just
thanks.
Imagine it. Imagine it the second before you're going to go on stage and give an address, somebody, the vice president, or doing that. It just would
It's getting back to our guest earlier today who said, you know, he's a touchy-feely guy, and that's right. And by the way, a lot of people feel that way. It's not just the people who are here. Imagine it for yourself for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine, you know, I'm a man, so I'm a little better shape on these issues than women are. Imagine you're focused on what you're, or you're not focused on what you're doing. You're standing somewhere and somebody who you hardly know, who's got a lot of power in the world, walks up to you. Did he put his hands on her shoulders? Like, was it the shoulders? Kissed her on top of the head and smelled her hair. I mean, it's just.
But in defense of Frank just months ago lost his wife.
And he was relating to him having lost,
tragedy. She drowned. And so I think maybe
Kate's entitled to disagree. I mean, there are a lot of people that feel that way. Yeah.
I'm going to cut him some
slack
on this.
I agree with you. I agree with you
completely. Still grieving.
877-301-8970. And I think you also have to address this much more directly. It's sort of like the comment the other day, I wish I could have done something. You know what that should have been? I could have done something, and I didn't, and I feel horrible about it, and I've learned from it. I don't understand why people can't address. You make a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody has made mistakes. Confront them. And people, I find, are generally forgiving if you're a straight arrow about, even if the only reason you did it is because you got caught.
But also, at the same time, Matt Damon got in a lot of trouble for differentiating among sexual harassers and abusers.
By the way, I agreed
rapists.
With him. It was just too early for him to be weighing in on this thing.
But we had to remember that, too. This is not Harvey Weinstein trying to rape somebody, or this is not the president of the United States.
No one's saying Joe Biden should go to jail, like we're saying Harvey Weinstein should either.
But it's important to point that out, that we have we have many more accusations and of much worse things against the president, and it did not interfere with his election whatsoever.
Right. People are free to vote. And if Joe Biden
decides to run. People are free to vote for him, just like they felt that Trump's behavior with women was insignificant enough that they could vote for him as well. Let's go to James in Webster. Hello.
How you doing?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, thank you for calling.
First off, Jim, I have to have you back. I think Marjorie interrupts you just as much as you interrupt her.
It's about time. I've waited 19 years for this phone call. Thank you, James. We're going to record
James.
This.
Jim is going to love you for that.
It's going to be on my voicemail starting tomorrow, James. Thank you very much. What's up?
She says, hold on and wait a minute a lot.
Okay, we got it. So, thank you for your back, defense.
Well,
I appreciate it.
That's because if I didn't say hold on and wait a minute, I never get to talk at all, James. That's why I have to do that.
Go ahead, James. What's your thought?
All right. I had no issues with Joe Biden until about 2 weeks ago, and I saw a video on social media. And my problem is not about the woman, which is also undefendable, but the children. Have you seen the videos?
Oh, yes.
Have you seen the young woman in the green dress that looks upset?
There's a bunch of them. He's like petting them and smelling them and putting his hands around them and whispering to them. I can't vote for this man. And I had no problems with him until I saw that.
Well, you're the second person, James, thank you for the call, by the way, who said they were a fan of Biden's and no more. By the way, if you haven't seen that video, that's the one I know you said to me this morning is most upsetting to you, as James said. And to me, she seems also to want to move away when he reaches his head towards her head.
And she's kind of cringing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Girl Scouts. Remember the thing that the Girl Scouts said that you don't, if your uncle, mothers and fathers, don't make your daughter hug your uncle if she doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Because she's probably got a reason she doesn't want to hug your uncle at Thanksgiving whenever he comes over the house. I love when they said that. That was great.
877-301-897. You know how this all, other than the underlying acts, it also, I think you may have made this point earlier, it feeds the notion, which I believe is an issue, is at 76 years old, you're too old to be president of the United States. What he did was fine, I guess. It shouldn't have been, but was fine when he did it. And he says, you know, I never meant to be. He's seen these videos, too. He knows what they were. And obviously, in retrospect, as he says, I never did believe I acted inappropriately. It's hard to watch these videos and say, even if your intentions were good at the time, that they were not inappropriate behavior.
You know, Robert just emailed and said, this topic is delicious, foreshadowing as to what the Democrat primary will become, a nightmare for liberals. And I think what Robert is implying is that the Democrats eat their own, that we go after all our own candidates, you know, like Beto O'Rourke had to explain himself. And I thought this was frankly ridiculous.
And the comment about his wife, you
when
mean?
He said that he takes care of his kids sometimes and he had to apologize. I mean, really, it's obvious if he's running for governor, he's running for
Senate
or Congress. Whatever he's running for, or president now, you're going to be out on the campaign trail and your wife is going to have to agree to pick up the slack during that time. So I thought that was crazy.
Well, yeah, there's an alternative, by the way. You remember what the nickname for John McCain was? And there were a
Straight
few,
Talk Express.
Yeah, and there were some moments, like in some primaries, where he was not Straight Talk Express. But the answer is then tell the truth. I mean, why didn't Beto O'Rourke say in response to that, you know, I respect everything my wife has done. I meant it as a self, and it was. I took it the way you did. It was a self-deprecating comment that I haven't done enough.
Right.
And I want you to know that I know it. It doesn't mean it's okay. Well, he wasn't asking for approval.
But I do think that the Democrats have to be careful of this, racing out to crucify everybody who says something a little bit, you know what I mean? We don't want to be so sensitive that we can't function here.
Jill Filipoff is on Twitter. If I can just read one of our coworkers just put on the screen. Not every untoward or inappropriate thing a man does is a Me Too. We can talk about gender dynamics and subtle instances of sexism without the really narrow frame is this sexual assault? Yes, no. I hadn't even thought of it to use the term sexual assault. I just thought it was inappropriate behavior. You shouldn't be touching somebody who didn't ask to be touched. You didn't invite you in.
Well, she's talking about the Matt Damon thing, the differentiation.
And there are degrees.
There are clearly degrees, which doesn't mean it's not wrong.
As you said before, Harvey Weinstein is not in the same category, obviously, or even in the same universe.
One of the worst things about Trump, aside from the kissing and the grabbing of thighs or whatever, is looking at those teenage girls changing their clothes.
I mean, in the
beauty pageant. That really gave me the creeps. Yeah. Corey in West Roxbury. Hi, Corey.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Excellent. Thank you. What's up?
So I actually got to meet Joe Biden about 10 years ago. So it was must have been 2008. And I was the only girl there, and he was going around the room and whatever. And he got to me, and I told him some things about myself, and he grabbed my hands, and he leaned in really close, and we touched heads, and he held me there for too long. And it was weird. I will admit it was, I was like, what's happening? Oh my God, this man is like in here. But the connection that we had, like, I believe that he cared about me in that really short period of time. Like, he heard what I had to say, and he was like, I think you're doing a great job, and I'm proud of you, and good luck, and blah, blah, blah. And, like, it was really nice. It was a really nice connection. And so I think, you know, I didn't ask for him to touch me in that way, but it wasn't creepy. And I didn't, and even though I was the only girl there, and I was young, and some could say I was a little cute and everything, I didn't take it as creepy. I took it as he took the time to hear me. And so after that, I don't know, I think he's great.
Hey, Corey, I'm so glad you called, actually. But before you go away, you were the only woman there, you said. Did he lean in and butt heads or whatever he did with you with any of the men?
You know, he didn't, Joe.
It's okay.
That's a good point. He didn't. But I think I also told him something that was a really, like, a personal thing. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what the other men said, but I doubt it was something as personal as I said. But that's a good point. Yeah, that's true.
Corey,
but
when was this?
It didn't feel creepy to me.
10 years ago. She thought it was 2008.
10 years ago. Okay, 10 years
ago. Yeah, 2008 when she was running for president the first time.
Okay.
Hey, we're really glad you called, Corey. Thanks for calling.
Oh,
thank
is
you.
Corey still there? You still there, Corey?
Yep. I just
wanted to ask you before you left. You know, sometimes there was always a joke, you know, that Tom Brady can't sexually harass anybody because he's Tom Brady.
It's SNL, that great routine,
yeah,
remember?
Yeah, they had Tom Brady running around in his underpants and grabbing people, grabbing women's breasts and stuff. I wondered whether part of it with you is that Biden's an attractive guy. He's a charismatic guy. If that was part of it, that there was, you know, he's not – you know, he's not a trench coat kind of guy. You know what I mean? Did that play into it at all?
Yeah, I think to me, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I was 25 at the time, okay. And he was, what, 65 at the time, probably. So I think I was around the age that his child would have been if the child had lived, and he had just talked about that. And so I think he viewed me more as his kid.
Okay.
You know, so it just wasn't creepy.
Corey, thank you very much. Well, that was a great call. Kate in the car, what do you think, Kate?
Well, I'm an old white woman, and I remember as a young woman playing into the sexism of those whom I might want a job from or when I was in graduate school, et cetera. And I'm thinking about the fact that this country is governed by old white men. I have, over the years, learned about my inherent racism, my inherent recognition and acceptance of sexism, which I shouldn't. There's a lot I've learned. I'm a very different person now, and I don't tolerate stuff. Those old white men who govern us and who run our corporations and are all around us have all the inherent stuff I had, I grew out of. I don't think many of them have.
Yeah, that's a great point, too.
Biden's behavior is uncle-ish behavior. And it can be creepy. It could be called creepy. It could be not. But it's behavior that would have been totally tolerated 40 years ago.
Yeah, but as you're making clear, not tolerated by choice in many instances, right? Tolerated because you had
40 years ago, I'm not sure we knew we had choice. Mm-hmm. Now we do.
Yeah.
No, now. Kate,
that's a great call.
Thank you
very much. Well, that's why the Anita Hill hearings were so revolutionary, because until Anita Hill, it was kind of like, hey, that's the way it goes. You know, take it or leave it, sweetheart.
You know, I'm thinking about Corey's call a minute ago, and I really appreciate her honesty and calling, because obviously that doesn't fit the sort of narrative of the day. But I wish I had said to her, and I'm sure she could appreciate this, you were fine with his leaning in.
Right.
In light of the fact that, what's the name of the woman from Nevada? Flores. Was not fine.
Correct.
Then the conclusion one reaches, then don't do it. Because while it is true that there may be some people who receive it well, there may be some people who totally reasonably don't receive it well, so don't put them in that position.
Exactly.
That's the end of the story.
And to get back to the uncle at Thanksgiving, you know, you may think it was really creepy how your uncle hugged you, and your cousin, who's the same age and another girl, may not. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he didn't hug that cousin the same way, you know what I mean?
Pete and Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Jim, Marjorie. Thank you. Call. I really appreciate it. I've called before. I really appreciate you taking my call again.
Thanks.
So I believe wholeheartedly that a woman, I mean, as if I have any stance to have an opinion in this matter, first of all, just
sure you do. Sure you do.
But I believe a woman, just like anybody else, has total control over her own body, has total say in who can touch her and who can interact with her, whatever. And if 5 years ago, she allowed that to happen, like the dynamic between Joe Biden and anybody is such that it's uncomfortable no matter what. I accept all that. But with that being said, we got to remember Democrats need to remember who they're up against. And we need to stop acting like Donald Trump, like the rules don't apply to Donald Trump. The guy has, 19 women accusing him of much more heinous acts than what Joe Biden is being pointed out to have done. And even though he didn't explicitly admit to it, his statement is more or less admitting that, you know, that he acts like that. So I just, like, while accepting and respecting the control a woman has over her own body and the consent that is required, especially these days in light of the empowerment from the Me Too movement, I just, it really gets me angry to feel like even liberals out there are calling out Joe Biden when Donald Trump is banging porn stars left and right and paying them off. And it's just,
you know, Pete, beautifully put that last part there, I should say. But putting it aside, responding to, I don't think that any normal person, I use normal as the operative word, would say that what Joe Biden is accused of is anywhere near as serious a violation as what Donald Trump is accused of. But because Donald Trump is, I'm using this term loosely, a felon when it comes to inappropriate behavior, doesn't mean you shouldn't call out a guy who's committed, let's call them misdemeanors, right? I mean, would you not agree?
I disagree.
Okay, go ahead.
I disagree with you there, only because unless someone comes out and has an accusation along the lines of who's that large congressman from Texas or whatever who was like, you know, there are so many other elected officials who have done sexual assault related activities versus things like this where the media will call it sexual misconduct as if it's some kind of felony.
But Pete, the media didn't call it. Ms. Flores did. And if Ms. Flores was made uncomfortable, I don't think it's very comforting to her to say, by the way, get over it, because imagine if Donald Trump had walked up behind you, how much worse it would be, right? Right?
I mean, my point is not, I agree with you. My point is not that she needs to get over it. My point is that the media and the other candidates out there should, especially on the Democratic side, should focus on differentiating themselves amongst each other and stop focusing on behavior that, while inappropriate maybe, or while inappropriate definitely in the eyes of Flores, mm-hmm. and inappropriate definitely in the eyes of even me, and it would make me uncomfortable if someone did that to me. I'm just saying that when you have a president who behaves and who the world is treating as if the rules don't apply, we can't focus on these types of issues unless it's an issue where it comes to criminal conduct.
Got it. We respectfully disagree. But, Pete, thank you for your call. We really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
We are moving on because we're going to talk to our TV man, Bob Thompson.
Can I just say before you do that, by the way, one of the women I'm going to have on with me tonight at Greater Boston worked for Joe Biden and does not think he crossed the line. So I hope you'll tune in to hear her perspective tonight.
Okay. That should be a good one, Jim. Coming up, as I said, our TV man, Bob Thompson, is here for his best and worst TV moments of the week. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you need some relief from real-life 2020 elections, the seventh and final, I'm so sad, final season of Veep offers some counter-programming with Selena Meyer's presidential run.
Leon,
yeah.
I'm not sure about this part where I say I want to be president for all Americans. I mean, do I? You know, all of them?
How about real Americans?
Oh, yeah, that's good. And okay. Then we can figure out what I mean later. This entire country is getting more disgusting by the second.
That's a demo we're targeting mostly on Facebook.
You have the second lowest vaccination rate in the nation, and when I am elected president, you will be number one.
I love this show. So does it make our political reality look better by comparison or worse? Joining us on the line for his take on this and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob.
Hello, and you had to find some clips that you could actually play over the air, because a good portion of this show, you can't. But, yeah, seventh and final season. When these seven episodes are done, it'll be a total of 65 episodes, 59 Emmy nominations, 17 wins.
Wow.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus got it 6 years in a row.
So great.
For the first six seasons. It got it for Best Emmy for Comedy, the show, for seasons 4, 5, and 6. So this has been lauded and awarded, even though it's so incredibly vulgar. Every single person on the entire cast would not want to spend 1 minute with, much less get stuck in an elevator with. And like Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's almost uncomfortable to watch. You squirm while you're watching it. But I don't know any other show that has got more hilarious lines per 5 seconds than this one does. They just never stop.
The whole cast is brilliant. And by the way, Marjorie, I don't know if you saw on Twitter this morning, our buddy Jimmy Tingle, who's a local comedian, was on 60 Minutes, too, years and years
yes.
ago. He is in a scene. I don't know if it's in the first episode, but he's on this season doing some sort of a thing. Can we play one other clip? I just love the show. I love her.
Go ahead.
Here's another clip.
You're welcome to play clips of this for the entire conversation.
Okay, great. Here's from the first episode of the new season. I think it started last night. Did it not?
It did.
Okay.
It's my best of the week.
Oh, great. Selena Meyer and Gary Walsh are writing a speech together. Here it is.
You know what I would like to tell people, but obviously I can't.
No, stay here.
I should be president.
Yep.
Because it is my goddamn turn. I was the game changer.
Yep.
I took a dump on the glass ceiling, and I shaved my muff in the sink of the old boys' club. But for 3 years, Hughes kept me chained to a radiator in some basement in Cleveland. So as far as I'm concerned, America owes me an 8-year stay in
yes.
the White House, and this time I want a war.
Yes. Do you want me to read that back?
Oh, we can't use any of that.
Oh.
I mean, it sounds like I'm shouting from a balcony in Munich.
It is great. It is.
By
the way, is this over because Dreyfus has had enough, or because they feel in the age of Trump it's not as something?
Well, I don't think it's that it's because of the age of Trump. It's seven seasons. I think it was
okay.
coming to its conclusion. And she's, of course, it's called Veep. She started out as the vice president. Then she became president
That's
for about
true.
10 minutes.
That's
and then
right.
she ran for president and lost. And now she's going to run again. I'm not sure how many different ways they can play this. And I think probably it's the perfect time to go. By the way, she's writing that speech, where she's trying to be asked to help write the speech throughout the whole thing. And there's so many great lines. One time they say, well, just use your own words. And she goes, if you want me to use my own words, write me something to say. And then, oh, at one point, oh, and take out the part about immigration. Way too issue-y.
Okay.
Great.
So if that's your best, Bob Thompson, what's your worst?
Well, that's my best, along with another, Barry, season 2, which won Henry Winkler his first Emmy for season
yeah.
1, and also Bill Hader. It debuted right after Veep, the beginning of its season, and that's worth – so it was those two.
Okay.
My worst, and get ready for this, Marjorie, because you might object to this one. You know Pimple Popper we talked about on TLC?
Yes, God.
Well, A&E, the, by the way, arts and entertainment network that when it started used to show opera and ballet, they've decided to top it with a show felicitously called The Toe Bro. And it essentially is a toe doctor. It's got doctor who specializes in feet. So mainly each episode is about warts, funguses, and especially ingrown toenails.
All right.
By the way, that isn't even appealing to someone who's got a foot fetish. Yeah, I mean, really.
John Parker got a clip of this for us. This is a specialist physician confronting a giant infected toe. And this is from the first episode of The Toe Bro.
Treating his first ingrown toenail was no big deal. Even though it was bad, it was infected and enlarged, it was nothing like his other toe, the toezilla. There's a lot of pus in this one.
This is disgusting.
And as I squeeze it, you can see it all coming out. I can see how much nail is hiding underneath the skin.
Peekaboo!
I see you.
So can you describe to me, television expert as you are, who is the target audience for this?
Well, I think there is. I mean, I understand Dr. Pimple Popper a lot more because there is a certain satisfaction to, and we've talked about this, and I can't believe we're talking about it again on public radio, but there is a certain satisfaction to having one of these pimples under pressure suddenly, you know, have this volcanic kind of release.
God.
I can sort of get that. And the host is very charming and whatever. This is a little different because a lot of this stuff is just plain gross. This toezilla or whatever they're calling he's really digging around and taking chunks of flesh.
Okay, fine, we're done.
Okay, it's lunchtime.
But the best part is when we hear him clipping this big, with almost horn-like, you can hear the crunch and the crackle. And I guess there's a big enough audience for that. Mm. I still have to reemphasize the fact this is on what used to be called the Arts and Entertainment Network.
Yeah, okay, Tobro. How far they have fallen.
I guess this is the arts part.
I may be missing
this
one.
Okay, let's move on to something that sounds very interesting. Patricia Arquette is a star. It's about this man child, I always mispronounce this, by proxy mom called The Act.
Yes, on Hulu. And you could see the first two episodes Wednesday. It's on Wednesdays, and it opened 2 weeks ago. You could see the first two, but then you had to start watching it only on Wednesdays. So this isn't something you can simply binge. Three episodes have played. Another one will play this coming Wednesday, the 3rd. And it's The Act is going to be an anthology drama. So each season they're going to do a new, completely new story, like we see on American Horror Story and lots of other things as well. It plays Patricia Arquette, who is raising this daughter and, you know, wants to keep her kind of sick and under her control. And she feeds her by tube directly through her stomach. When she eats a pizza, it goes through the blender first. This woman has, forget a medicine cabinet, she has a medicine closet. But Patricia Arquette, after that incredible performance in Escape from Dannemora, has once again proven herself to be the new Meryl Streep.
By the way, that's the same disease from Patricia Clarkson in Sharp Objects with Amy Adams, isn't that? Yes, that was. Well, I can't pronounce it either.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I don't. I haven't diagnosed exactly. By the way, this is based on real events. We should underline the word "based on," but
yeah. I think it's basically when you make up these diseases that your child has because it makes you more important because you're the parent
child,
that's rescuing them.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's play a scene. This is Dee Dee Blanchard, the one that's played by Patricia Arquette, talking to her new neighbors about all the medical ailments her daughter suffers from.
She's got the epilepsy, paraplegia, a heart murmur. She can barely take anything by mouth. And, well, she's anemic.
How the heck do you manage?
Oh, I sleep with one eye open, I suppose.
Me too. Can't watch him forever, though, right? Male's a great mom. Especially if you believe in tough love.
I just don't believe in spoiling them.
Of course. You gotta teach them to fend for themselves as soon as they can walk.
Oh, Mel, everything is different with my gypsy. She can't fend for herself. She'll never be able to. I have to do everything for her.
That's a great
accent. She's a great actress. She's
fabulous. I'm
And this is a very creepy show, and it's not fun creepy. It's just plain creepy, but it's very, very compelling.
Is it creepy as Tobro?
Well, that's my fear. I don't know if I have time to watch Tobro and this, so maybe sometime I'll catch up in the summer.
Yeah, okay. We got another one that sounds a little creepy. Is Hannah?
Yes.
This is
on Amazon, so you can watch all 8 episodes. It debuted a couple days ago on the 29th, based on a 2011 movie. This is creepy, but this is a lot of fun creepy.
Oh,
about
good.
This woman, a young girl from the age of like a baby, has been raised in the movie. I think it was in the Finland woods. Here it's just north of Poland, but in the middle of nowhere by her assassin father to be the perfect assassin, the perfect shot. And oh, by the way, she's also been genetically altered. So in episode 1, they actually have to leave the forest. She's turned 15. And this becomes an action-adventure thriller of this woman who has young woman who has every trick in the book, at the same time who has for the first time gotten out into the civilized world and wants to be a teenager. Episode 2, where she makes her first friend, is really a beautiful, touching episode while she's breaking everybody's neck around her.
That's great.
Okay.
And I mean literally breaking their neck.
I don't think we have sound for that. No,
no,
we don't.
Thankfully we don't.
Okay.
We're going to play the Tobro sound again
really,
in a minute.
I think it's a wonderful show. And again, this one you can go on Amazon and watch all 8. And if you get started, if you make it through the first bit, it's likely you will want to continue.
You know how spoiled I am, by the way? When I heard that Veep was on last night, I'm really excited. I'm going to watch the show. And then I forgot it was on HBO. Which means you only had 1 episode. And I mean, how pathetic is that? I've been so conditioned by this binging sickness that I didn't even watch a show I wanted to watch because I didn't want to be limited to just 30 minutes. It's really...
It's going to take you 7 weeks to get through this one, whether you like it or not.
I love that. I hate binging.
I know you don't.
Because
I
find yourself at 3 o'clock in the morning and you've been sitting there like a couch potato, literally. Okay, so
I'm with Jim. And not only do I get upset about it, it's like you get this sense of entitlement.
Exactly right.
No place for me to go to see
exactly.
this. Like,
how dare they?
Heck of a nerve.
What's this world coming to, kind of thing.
Okay, so what's going on with One Day at a Time? A change is upon us.
Netflix canceled,
oh,
right?
I've given this a best every time its new season has begun. I still think it's a wonderful show with a lot of direction to go. But Netflix, which used to not cancel anything, has canceled it. So its third season will be its last. And Norman Lear, who's 96 and a half years old, one of the executive producers, was quoted as saying, "You are never too old to have your heart broken."
Is he really 96?
Which, by the way, I say, be thankful. Most people's hearts have long broken by 96.
Is he really 96?
I think he's 96 and change.
I thought I had read the story on this, is that the stars or the producers or the somebody, maybe it was Norman Lear, I don't know, had said that while Netflix had canceled it, they were hopeful, and I don't know if it was just rhetoric, that they were about to get picked up elsewhere. Did I read it wrong?
Yeah, well, everybody's been talking about that, and I think it's very likely that that could happen, and that would be a real turnaround, because it used to be we thought of Netflix as being the place where you could fall if you got canceled from one of the more traditional venues, especially the networks. If One Day at a Time ends up on a network after starting on Netflix, it'll demonstrate how that is a revolving door, not just a one-way door.
Okay, so what to watch this week, Bob?
Ah, you can start this now if you have CBS All Access, and this may be something that will get people to subscribe to that. The new Twilight Zone with Jordan Peele in the role that Rod Serling once played. He's the host and introduces things and narrates them. He's also the co-executive producer. That starts today, so it should be up on CBS All Access now. There's 10 episodes. And think of the year that Jordan Peele has been having, or the week for that matter. I mean, of course, he did Get Out, which won all kinds of awards, directed and wrote it. He was co-producer of Black Klansman, which won all kinds of awards. Everybody has been talking about Us, which he directed, wrote and produced. He co-created The Last OG with Tiffany Haddish and Tracy Morgan on TBS. Jordan Peele is becoming a real entertainment mogul.
You know, I want to play a clip from the trailer for The Comedian, which is a new episode of the new Twilight Zone. But after that's over, I want to talk to you for a minute
about the original, which I didn't know until this weekend. I'm reading in the New York Times. All the old episodes, I think, are on Netflix, and I am dying.
It was so scary.
Let's get back to that, though, in a second. Here's, again, from The Comedian, which is a new episode of The New Twilight Zone. Here it is.
What do you want? You happy with your life? With your career? Don't you want it all?
More than anything.
You will get laughs.
You totally killed tonight.
You will be successful.
Where's our dog?
We don't have a dog.
What did you do to me?
Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
You know, I don't know what the venue was for this, but about 20 years ago, maybe somebody gave me DVDs or something. I watched like 10 episodes of the original Rod Serling from, what, a half century ago or something.
Right.
They were as good television as anything I've ever seen. Were you
the
a
music,
fan?
The music was really good,
music
too.
Was great.
I kind of like the...
Go ahead.
Rod Serling was born here in Syracuse, New York.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Really?
1924 or something like that. But yes, and it did, you know, this show ran from 1959 to 1964. Mm-hmm. So while all this stuff was going on, civil rights, the Cold War, moving into Vietnam and all of that kind of thing, entertainment television completely ignored that stuff. As I always say, it was about entertainment TV did flying nuns and talking horses. But shows like The Twilight Zone were rare opportunities where you could sneak in these socially relevant stories because they were disguised as happening on other planets or in some kind of weird psychological space that wasn't so you could talk about these things without actually talking about them. Now, every episode was not a masterpiece. They expanded to an hour for a while, and that show did not survive nearly as well artistically with an hour. Half hour was just perfect. And it's been remade at least once. Well, they did the movie, and CBS during the 80s actually brought back The Twilight Zone before, so this is by no means its first what we now call reboot, but it looks like a really ambitious one, and as you point out, Jim, it's a tough act to follow.
By the way, as I'm looking, my phone just exploded with a number of texts. Four friends of mine, this is how pathetic I am.
You must have a Samsung.
Four friends, I do actually, four friends of mine just texted me how to pronounce Munchausen by proxy.
Oh, we had some emailers, too.
They felt sympathy,
yeah,
obviously.
Munchausen, is, I pronounced it wrong.
By proxy. So thank you all for doing that. Before you go, do you teach Twilight Zone?
I do, and it was very difficult to choose which episode to teach. And by the way, a lot of my students will have never seen them.
Right.
I teach the one where the woman, they never show the faces of the doctors, but the woman is all bandaged up. And it turns out in the end that her surgery didn't work. She's still ugly. But she, in fact, looks like what we would call an extraordinary, beautiful woman. And then we see all the doctors.
That's
and they
great.
All
I remember
oh,
that.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I remember that one, too. I remember the person standing on the
wing
of the
airplane,
too, and the person looked out the window. But I don't remember this one with Mickey Rooney.
I do.
Last night of a jockey. The jockey
wanted to be
taller.
Bigger.
So what happened? Did he get squished by
watch
the room?
Watch the show, Marjorie.
I can't watch the show, Jim.
Hey, Bob, that was great.
That Mickey Rooney Comedian might have started out as a live TV show in an anthology show in the 50s before it went to Twilight Zone. I'm not sure about that.
By the way, what I'm going to send you a video of to teach next time you teach anything about Mickey Rooney, on my old television station, I had Mickey Rooney on for his 80th birthday, and it was on live.
Right.
And as he's on live, a producer walks out onto the set with a birthday cake with 80 candles lit. And none of us realize that 80 candles on a cake is practically the towering inferno. And he leans over to blow out the candles. And you know when you have that quick thought knowing, I killed Andy Rooney? It was clear to me that he was going to expire on the – but in any case, I'll send it to you. It's good. Hey, Bob, thank you.
He didn't burst into flame, did he?
No, but almost. Hey, Bob,
yes,
thanks for your time.
Please send that tape.
I will.
Thank you very much. Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founder and director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse.
Let's you and I watch old Twilight Zones before Bob's on next week.
What happened to
we'll
Mickey Rooney?
We'll pick a couple.
Did he get squished
I'm
by the room?
I'm not telling you. And we'll discuss it with Bob next week.
Up next, the world's environmental reporter is back from her 7-week expedition to Antarctica. Carolyn Beeler joins us next for a recap. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For 7 weeks, Carolyn Beeler, the environment reporter for The World, was on Antarctica, an Antarctica expedition, living and working among a group of scientists who were studying Thwaites Glacier, how quickly it's melting, and what it would mean for global sea levels in coastal cities. We've been checking in with Carolyn along the way. Now that she's back, we're actually talking to her in person. She joins us for a recap of her time aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer research vessel. Welcome home, Carolyn. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here in person.
Yeah. So it must be kind of an adjustment to come home after all this time. But for people that haven't been listening to us over these weeks or seeing the stuff online, just give us a recap. What were you doing?
I was with a group of international scientists studying Thwaites Glacier, as you said, which is a glacier the size of Florida that's melting fast, and it could contribute 1 to 2 feet to sea level rise within the next century. So this expedition that I covered was the first of a first part of a five-year research expedition to study how much and how fast it might contribute to sea level rise.
And the issue is not if it is. The issue is how fast it is. Is that not correct? Or is
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I mean, it's melting. So, you know, the question is, will it collapse? Will it take the rest of West Antarctica with it? It's looking like that is likely, but how fast that happens is really important for cities like Boston that have to plan for sea level rise.
Can you describe to us again, as you have every week beautifully, what it was like there? And I know you're sick of me saying this. Every week I say to Carolyn, because I
no
can't believe it.
No human.
No human had ever been where she
surprise,
and her colleagues
surprise.
Had been. It's just, it gives me chills. Tell people what you encountered there.
Yeah, it was thrilling. It was amazing to be up against the front of this glacier, which nobody had ever seen before. You know, taking this being on this ship, the bridge of this ship, as it sailed 100 meters away from the face of this glacier. And it was really astounding to be down there and see this great wall of ice and be surrounded by water for weeks and weeks and weeks and not see any other humans, and think about how much this ice that we were seeing could raise sea level on this, you know, for global oceans. You know, we were out in this ocean for weeks and weeks and weeks, didn't see any other humans, and there's still enough mass of ice on Antarctica to really change, you know, the sea level, not just where we were, but everywhere.
You know, Marjorie and you talked last week when you were, I think, on your way to Chile, you were on your way back, and Marjorie asked you about the sounds and, you know, other than the cracking of the ice, that sort of thing. I don't think we asked you about this. Do you know Kelly Beattie from Sky and Telescope magazine? He's this wonderful guy who writes about those kinds of things.
Mm-mm.
And he's deeply involved in something called the dark sky movement.
Yeah.
And there's actually a bill on Beacon Hill to deal with light pollution at night and the impact it has on our health and the environment, that sort of stuff. So, at night, what was it like there? What did you see?
So I didn't see night until 5 or 6 weeks into our journey because it was day, you know.
Oh, of course.
Day
yeah.
all day.
Yeah.
This, I think the sun set on the Antarctic Circle sometime around February 7th for the first time this year. So,
oh, my God.
So we had this, like, amazing golden hour for, like, 4 or 5 hours a day in the evening, which was really cool. So I actually didn't see night.
Hold on. When you say golden hour,
yeah.
Where is the sun in that golden hour?
So it's, like, you know, the hour before sunset
yes.
here in Boston, where everything is beautiful and sparkly and golden. So the sun was just at this, it just made everything look beautiful for hours every day.
Because it's kind of in the same position.
Low on the horizon.
Yes. Oh,
yeah.
Neat.
Yeah. So sort of pre-sunset colors. But yeah, so I didn't see night started happening, but I was never up for it until about 2 weeks and 2 weeks left of our journey. And then there were a lot of clouds and stuff. So I did see stars like one or two nights, and that was pretty spectacular.
We're talking to Carolyn Beeler. What?
So it looks like there's a lot more of them, needless to say, than if you look out the window at midnight in Brighton.
Yeah, they're very clear. And it's the Southern Hemisphere, so it's all different constellations, which is very cool.
Oh, gosh, that's right.
Describe to people the kinds of experiments that were done to attempt to answer the questions you said were posed by this five-year mission.
So there's a lot of different science going on. One of the experiments involved sending for the first time an automated underwater vehicle, an AUV, so a robotic submarine.
What's that thing called again?
The brand or the creators call it the Hugin.
Hugin, that's
right.
But
the scientist who was in charge of it on the ship has named this one Ran, which is the Nordic goddess of the sea. Oh. So. Yeah, so she's a woman on the ship.
And what was culled from that?
So a lot of the science that was conducted on the ship still needs to be written, like the data needs to be analyzed and needs to be written up and published before there'll be sort of concrete findings. But this AUV went under Thwaites Glacier to map a portion of the seabed underneath the glacier to determine some history of its retreat in the past. It also collected water samples, so they'll be able to figure out where the water under there is coming from, how much of it is meltwater, how much of it is water coming from other places. And doing a lot of really, really detailed analysis of the temperature and salinity of water that's reaching the face of the glacier to see, you know, how much warmth is being brought to it to melt it.
And why is it melting underwater?
So changes in currents and circulation that is thought to be linked to climate change is pushing up something that's called circumpolar deep water. So warm ocean water that actually starts way up in the North Atlantic. It's pushing that water up onto the continental shelf in front of Antarctica. And it's bringing that slightly warmer water up underneath the floating lip of Thwaites Glacier and is melting it. So most of this research was looking at, you know, just how much of that water is getting to Thwaites. In fact, is it getting there? Modeling suggests that it is, but up until this point, you know, that hadn't been observed in observational studies. So a lot of the research is looking at how much of that warm water is newly or thought to be newly being brought up to the ice on Antarctica.
You know, we're talking to Carolyn Beeler, who's just back from Thwaites Glacier. I don't know if I mentioned no one has been where she was before. I don't think I've mentioned that before.
Yeah.
So did everything work? I understand the data is still being analyzed, but, you know, for example, when you mentioned this AUV, is that the proper?
Yeah. Yep.
Obviously, it hadn't been in waters like that there. Other things that they concocted back in the labs and back, did everything at least work the way they intended it to work or no?
I think so. I think nothing ever goes quite according to plan on cruises like this. But yeah, that AUV, once they ironed out sort of the deployment and recovery of it and how to make sure it didn't come up through sea ice, it worked. The sonar, so echo sounding mapping equipment on the ship is a pretty like tried and true technology, so that worked. The scientists who were looking for seals to tag with sensors that would send data back to the lab for a year, they actually found enough seals to do this with. So I think overall they would say it was a success, the scientists on the ship.
You know, one of the things that you talked about, which I had never even thought of or knew existed, was all these different kinds of ice. Tell us again about ice formations.
Well, there's different kinds of ice in Antarctica. The glacier that, you know, they were going down to study starts on the landmass of Antarctica, and then it sort of flows off of the continent to hang in the sort of floating lip a little bit over the edge of the land. So that's one thing. There's the glaciers. There's also icebergs, which are pieces that break off of glaciers and then flow, you know, hundreds of miles away. And those come in all shapes and sizes. You know, I saw a little one that looked like an octopus floating in the water. You saw giant ones that are miles and miles long that look like, you know, flat rectangular tabletops. And they can be all different kinds of textures and colors, especially when the light is hitting them differently. And then there's sea ice, which is when the top layer of the ocean or seawater freezes. It starts in sort of thin, flexible, malleable layers of ice, and then it firms up into it can be meters thick, and then snow falls on it and it compresses. So, you know, you have different categories of ice, and it can be in all these different textures and colors from white like snow to the blue like on a clear blue day.
And not all of it flat either, because of the pushing together of these pieces of ice. So you'd have these huge, like little peaks, well, not necessarily huge, but peaks in the ice, which I'd never, because you think of ice as just like a flat surface. Yeah. Actually, everybody's ice skating on it. You know, are you going to ask something?
No, you go ahead.
You, in your story, you talked about some of the researchers' feelings about why they were there. You quote this guy, Bartolotto, who's from Brazil, who was bittersweet about, you know, thinking about his two-year-old son and climate change.
Yeah, it was interesting when I asked the scientists on the ship about the emotions they feel when they're studying climate change and how they deal with those. Because you often hear activists or, you know, just anybody you meet on the street say, you know, I feel overwhelmed or depressed or, you know, some other emotion about climate change. But when I asked scientists about this, they mostly said, you know, I'm trained to divorce myself from any emotion. I'm trained to gather data and look at it and have no presupposition about what it will tell me. So generally, there was less emotion in this work than I was expecting. But there were also scientists who recognized, you know, there's my science head. So Guy Bortolotto, who you're talking about, said, you know, I'm not thinking about my two-year-old son when I'm doing this work, or my hometown, which is in a coastal city in Brazil. You know, I'm not thinking about that when I'm doing this work. I'm thinking about this global problem and how we're going to solve it. But, you know, when I'm at home or later, I am worried about climate change as one of the things that a parent worries about for their child.
So how about you? Are you like really being good about your bringing your bags to the supermarket now? Composting and all that kind of stuff? I mean, it must have had an impact on you.
Yeah, it did. And it would, you know, it's a lot of complicated feelings, I guess. But one of the things that it's made me think about a lot is how connected we are to places that feel very far away and very not connected. So the choices we make and the policies that are enacted here in Boston are having an impact on what's happening in Antarctica, even though it's so far away and feels very remote. And you know, what is happening down there will then have an effect on what happens here in terms of what our coastline looks like.
How many countries were the scientists from? How many different countries?
Roughly. I had several.
Did those who were not from the United States venture any thoughts about our outlying position on climate change issues or no?
I think they were relatively diplomatic when I broached this topic with them, and I think a lot of them sort of thought about the long arm of climate policy, if you want to say, thinking that, you know, eventually there will be action taken. It just depends on whether it's soon enough.
You know, when Marjorie asked you a minute, Carolyn Beeler, about that connection thing. I don't know what the question was that led to you saying, you know, you felt a connection. What we do here has an impact on that. That has an impact.
Yeah.
You know, it seems
I asked
like
her if she was composting
a world away. What is the thing that had the most profound impact on you? Was it that realization? Or, I mean, this is where you are the environment reporter at your place, but this is a place you hadn't been either.
Yeah.
What was the biggest takeaway for you?
I think it was sailing through the Southern Ocean in the Amundsen Sea, and for weeks and weeks and weeks, all we saw was this vast blue ocean. We didn't see anything man-made for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Is that really so?
And of course, the water is, you know, hundreds of meters deep, a mile deep in some places. And to think about the amount of water that has to be added to global seas to raise them by feet, and to think that we as humans are doing something that will create those effects on this earth, that is a very sobering thought. And it's something that makes you think about the impact that we're all having on the earth.
Well, probably no one talked about this because, as you said, that they separate their work from their from their emotions about climate change, or this Brazilian from his two-year-old kid. But we talked about this with Heather Goldstone. There's not a lot of good news on climate change. I mean, the president of the United States thinks it's a hoax. He's talking about drilling offshore on the coast of America for gas and oil. Even countries that got into the climate, the Paris Accord, are not. Some of them are not keeping up. It's going to be hard. You know, they're scientists, they're not politicians, but I think I'd be a basket case if I was doing this.
You are a basket case.
Well, I am a basket case. But you know what I mean?
On this issue, I mean.
I think part of I think a lot of us feel helpless when it comes to climate change because it's such a big issue. You know, we can compost and we can bring our reusable bags to the grocery store, but it's hard to feel like that's going to be enough, right? You're just one person. But I think this scientists feel like they are doing something. They're helping us better understand what's in store so that we can hopefully plan for it better. So I think there is that difference in terms of how the folks I was living with and interviewing deal with this, which is they feel empowered to be doing something about it. If it's not coming up, you know, if it's not fixing it, it's at least better understanding what we're in store for. So I think that was a really different way that they were interacting with and, you know, dealing with climate change was that they felt like they were doing something.
Oh, didn't you see 60 Minutes last night? George Church at Harvard is going to recreate the woolly mammoth.
The permafrost.
Which is
going to
step on the permafrost and all that. You know, you're too young to remember a great song. Well, I'm too young even for this. Peggy Lee sang a song, Is That All There Is?
Yeah.
Do you worry after an experience like that? Like, what's the encore? I mean, I know you do a lot of great work. I've read a lot of your stuff, actually, while you've been away.
Going to the moon, Jim.
But that really is a tough act to follow,
Mars.
Isn't it? I'm serious.
Yeah, it was a pretty exceptional reporting experience. Yeah. So
it's always the first thing you ate when you came back.
I read a salad.
What giant salad.
I would go to Thwaites Glacier to avoid having to have a salad. She wanted to come home to have one.
I'd be at Dunkin' Donuts, I think.
I had a very large kale salad with cabbage and carrots.
Did it live up to expectations?
Oh, yeah. It was so good.
Fresh vegetables, so not really in plenty on the boat.
Right.
But I saw you had some nice little Mardi Gras pastries. That was pretty good. So there was a lot of pastries on the boat, I take it.
The food was good.
It was good?
Yeah.
No liquor.
No liquor, right. Yep. So actually the first thing we did when we got back to port was we all went to a bar and had a drink.
Oh, fun.
That was very nice. Yeah.
Yeah, your reporting on this has been great, I have to say. I mean, I know I speak from what we learned a lot. And also the photographs. People should go online. Your photographs are really powerful. They're really, really great. And we loved having you call in, too. Thanks so much for doing that.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Home.
Yeah, thank you very much, Carolyn. We really appreciate it.
This is unbelievable. Marjorie, just think about this for a minute. Our next guest is Joe Matthew. Where did he spend the weekend?
Cuba.
And where did she spend the last 8 weeks?
She was in Antarctica.
And where do we spend the weekend?
We went to Quincy. Before.
Exactly.
It was very exciting.
There's something wrong with this picture. I don't know what it is, but there is something
We're going down to the Back Bay tomorrow, Jim.
I wasn't allowed to go, actually. You're going by yourself.
We just don't get very far. Okay. Thank
Carolyn,
you very much, Carolyn Beeler.
Carolyn
Beeler is an environment reporter for The World, which you can catch right here on 89.7 at 3 o'clock and 8 o'clock Mondays through Fridays. Carolyn, great to talk to you, and congratulations on a great adventure. Coming up, we are observing National Poetry Month with Richard Blanco. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And joining us on the line to kick off National Poetry Month is Richard Blanco. Richard's the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history. His latest book of poetry is How to Love a Country, which deals with various socio-political issues that shadow America. On Thursday, April 25th, you can catch Richard Blanco in person for a reading at the Boston Public Library. That'll be at 6 p.m. on the 25th. And he will be joined by Marjorie and me.
That's
We're
right.
really excited.
I'm very excited. I'm
Richard,
very excited
great
this.
To talk to you, Richard.
great to be. It seems we've been a while without talking, but great to be back for National Poetry
Month. I know.
Month,
great to be. And I had never, shame on me, I suppose, even heard of an acrostic. Can you please tell
it's
us
a pretty, it's,
what this
it's
is?
A pretty neat, it's a pretty neat and kind of fun and pretty easy kind of form. So basically, it's easier when you just see it visually. But basically, all the first letters of the poem on the left margin, spell out a word or a phrase or whatnot. So that's your sort of parameter. You have to write a word with each first letter that begins each line of the poem. And it's pretty old stuff. They used to do it in the medieval era. The monks used to write the names of the saints on the side. It goes as back old as the Greek. It's even in the parts of the Old Testament. There's acrostics. And it kind of is a version of the Abecedarian, which is basically the whole alphabet where every line begins A, B, C, D, E. So this is sort of a take on that. So I thought we could do something fun for National Poetry Month with our listeners and have them do acrostics. What do you think about that?
Great. I think it's great.
Explain the rules. Remember we did zip codes,
yeah,
a couple of months ago, which was huge. We got a huge number of participants. Explain what the rules of the game are, and then we'll read some.
Yeah, and some tips. And so basically it's taking off the zip code. So this is maybe a zip code on steroids. Because if you have a really long town name, that might be a problem. But so basically the idea is that the letters, again, on the left-hand margin of the poem should spell the name of your town. And so it's kind of an ode to the town. I mean, we can take many different subjects, whatever it is, maybe talk about spring. But the idea is to celebrate or talk about or describe the town in some ways, and the acrostic will spell the name of the town. So what are some of the longer named towns around the Boston area? Gloucester or Gloucester?
Yeah, Gloucester, that'd be a good one. Leicester, Attleboro.
And is the subject matter of the, in addition to having your city or town down the left-hand margin, does the subject matter should be about your city or town, right?
Yeah. Let's try and do that. Just to, I mean, a lot of the sort of the challenge of free verse in some ways is just to find a parameter to help you focus your writing. So yes, let's try and do it about the town, or whether that's maybe a character in the town, or something about the town, something obviously that has to do with life in your town, in your city.
And the deadline for submission is April 29th to bprwgbh.org. We'll give it to you again in a minute.
By the way, that'd be great.
You want to be amazed by Marjorie?
What are you amazed by,
Jim? I mean,
Jim?
Considering you're so much more literary than I, and you hadn't heard of this.
I hadn't.
When you were in school, you didn't. The first poetry writing I ever did in school was my friends and I picked the dirtiest word we knew and did it down the left-hand margin, and we thought we were the cleverest people ever, and we wrote these crappy poems off curse words. I mean, really. Yeah.
Disgraceful.
And they're really fun. They usually are a great introduction in grade school for kids to, you know, it makes them feel
fun,
a little more comfortable in writing the poem. But did you get my note about those interesting acrostic letters?
Oh, mention the science advisor guy.
Yeah.
I love this one.
Yeah, and I remember hearing about it. I was like, cool.
Me too.
Like, his poetry's made it in. Well, it's not poetry because they're writing in prose, but the first letter, I think if each paragraph spelled something. I'll just read it verbatim here, but it said a former science envoy, Daniel Kamen, tweeted out a resignation letter to address Trump that featured the acrostic in peach. And then there was somehow this is a Trump phenomenon, because then also the Trump's advisory council had another kind of hidden message when they resigned after the whole Charlottesville issue, and it spelled resist. So there's an example. It's kind of like this coded message, right? So that's kind of fun. But it's a great introduction sometimes, because again, it takes the pressure off. It gives you a little guidance in the poem. And I wanted to say also some other tips, like don't feel like each line of the poem has to be like one complete sentence with a period, but rather it can flow, you know, the description or whatever you're writing by can flow right into the next line. It doesn't have to be end stopped, as we call in poetry. It could be much more flowy. Don't feel just because. And obviously, the easiest thing is to write the letters right down. You begin by writing the letters right down the left margin, and then start working and stitching in between those letters. So that should be fun.
By the way, before you go today, Marjorie and I took our first crack at this. So if you read a few of your favorites, we will then send people home with a few of ours.
I would like to say that you broke the rules.
Well, I realized I screwed up the rules.
You're supposed to do it with a town.
I did it with
Jim
my name.
Did it with his three-letter name. Well,
I
wanted
and put a bad word in there, right?
I did. Yeah. So read us a couple of your favorites, Richard Blanco.
Like screw Eastbury or whatever. So, you know, it was difficult because when I first thought about this, I thought there'd be a lot of examples online. Of course, I'm just trying to access things that are, you know, public domain or things that we can use. But there weren't that many examples. But one interesting one was Through the Looking Glass, the last, so let me make sure I get this right, from Lewis Carroll, obviously. Mm-hmm. The last, I think towards the end of the book, there is an acrostic poem that spells out Alice Pleasance Little, which is Alice's real name. I'll just read that. I'm not crazy about the poem per se, but it's kind of just interesting watch. And it says, a boat beneath a sunny sky, lingering onward dreamily in an evening of July. Children three that nestle near, eager eye and willing ear, pleased a simple tale to hear. Long has paled that sunny sky, echoes fade and memories die. Autumn's frost has slain July. Still she haunts me, phantom wise, Alice moving under skies, never seen by walking eyes. Children yet, the tale to hear, eager eye and willing ear, lovingly shall nestle near. In a wonderland they lie, dreaming as the days go by, dreaming as the summers die. Ever drifting down the stream, lingering in the golden gleam, life, what is it but a dream? So,
it's not bad. It's better than mine.
It's actually great when you read it out loud, of course, because there's so much musicality in it. But you know that last stanza really, and I researched this. Doesn't that sound like row, row, row your boat?
Ever
drifting down the stream, lingering in the golden gleam, life. Yeah. What is it but a dream? But it's not, apparently. But I think someone stole that for Row, Row, Row.
So is there a great poem in the minds of a great poet like you that's an acrostic? Or are they all just sort of, I don't want to say gimmicky, because obviously that makes it too cheap. But you know what I mean. Is there a great work of poetic art that's an acrostic?
You know, I've come across them. Again, I'm just trying to work with what I can find online and not, you know, steal people's poems, mm-hmm. so to speak. But I know I know there's a couple of poets that really get into this. And one of them is Denise Duhamel. And I remember reading a couple of really brilliant ones in one of her books. I can't remember offhand. A lot of poets also do, again, a version of this, which is the Abecedarian. Mm-hmm. And those I've seen more often here in books and whatnot. But, I just got to have access to what's online when preparing this. So I encourage readers to actually, you know, look for that and see what you can find online, too, as other examples. But also, you might be surprised. Some of poetry you might be lying around there, you might have come across an acrostic and never even knew it.
Yeah. So read us another.
Sure. I'm going to read a little short one, which I think is a little more... certainly not like the one we just read. And it's called Ephemeral Bloom, and it's an acrostic sonnet by Diane Hine. Each day in cotton gloves, the artist works, perfecting gorgeous flowers made of silk, harmoniously hued and ever perked, eternal, unlike fresh ones of their ilk. Meandering back home, midst evening's gloom, encounters in a sad, neglected park, retiring non-attention, seeking bloom, and feels a stirring of compassion spark. Let's drop her woolly mitt and stoops to touch beneath the leaves. Dropped petals slowly fade, lamenting tarnished loveliness unsuch, none such. Obliquely for a moment, two lives braid. Offhand, there is no purpose for a glove. Mortality is tantamount to love. That's a kind of a cute, but I'll read one real quick.
Ephemeral bloom. I mean, every, you know, it's neat that you just go down the first
letter. Well, it's the
letters.
Whole concept
I know,
here.
But it's pretty neat.
Marjorie, by the way, you're not in the studio here, but I want you to know, I've known Marjorie for a long time. Mm-hmm. She's looking really cocky, meaning I have a feeling that she really nailed it with this poem of hers. We'll hear
really
in a couple of minutes.
Okay, but I you cheated, so I already
didn't cheat intentionally.
I already have a point in advance.
I thought it was supposed to be our name, and my name
Jim
only has three letters.
Write a poem about Jim. I mean, you know, we knew that was going to happen. Suppose I had to write one for Marjorie. That would take me forever.
It would for forever. Okay, fine. Okay. Right. What's next?
So I just want to read this little one because that's an example of a town. Mm-hmm. And this is what they call, this is for now, this is an even greater challenge, the double acrostic. So that the letters not only spell the word on the right, on the left-hand margin, but also on the left-hand margin.
Oh, that's impossible.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Oh, my God.
So if you want to be, if you're a glutton for punishment and really want to challenge yourself even further. And this one's about Stroud, and I tried to do a little research on it, and you'll see the subject matter. And it really is about the town. And so it says, this is by Paul Hansford.
So wait a minute. So it's got to start with an S.
It ends with an S.
For Stroud.
And ends with an S. The next line starts with a T.
Okay. All right. We're ready. We're ready. Right.
Set among hills in the midst of five valleys, this peaceful little market town we inhabit refuses vociferously to be to be a conformed. Once home of the cloth it gave its name to, uphill and down again its streets lead you. Despite its faults, it leaves us all charmed.
That's
and
impossible.
That's really clever.
That's giving me a headache just thinking about that.
It has to do actually with Stroud, if my research is correct, it was where they invented broadcloth or Stroud, which is a kind of woven wool thing. So it's paying tribute to
once home of the cloth that gave its name
and the mill town and whatnot. So, yeah, I'm sad that I couldn't find some. There were some great alphabets of the abecedarians, but we're not gonna do those. So are we gonna hear your poems?
I think we should. Now I wrote two.
Just as inspiration.
You wrote two.
I did.
You
well, it's only three
again.
Letters.
He
I didn't
again.
Cheat. First of all, I have two because originally I wrote and I did screw up. I forgot it was a town.
Okay.
I should have done Cambridge. I did Jim instead, which happens to be my name. So I wrote one that was not a rhyme, and then Marjorie embarrassed me and says hers rhyme. So I'll read you my rhyme first, and then you do yours, Marjorie, and then I'll read you the one that doesn't rhyme, okay?
Yes.
My name, by the way, for those who do not know at home, is Jim.
Jim.
J-I-M. Okay?
Okay, I'm writing it down.
Okay. You ready?
I'm ready.
Don't look at me while I'm doing this. Look down or look to the side, okay? Richard, you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Just waiting. I'm hoping this contest will be elating. But me, I'm worried it could be deflating. Now, that is pretty good,
I
isn't
like
it?
That.
I knew you would, yeah.
That just does rhyme.
Yeah, I just said it. I did the rhyme. I understand.
Like that.
And waiting. They all three rhyme.
That's very good.
So you do yours, and I'll do. What do you think, Richard? Be honest.
It's good. Very cute. Very good. I like it. It's kind of very. Well, the three letters make it very haiku-ish, too. So that's
what was my
neat.
Goal. I was trying to achieve the haiku acrostic.
I would like to point out here that I follow the rules, doing a town and telling something about the town.
And where are you from? Did you do Fall River?
No, I did Boston.
You're not from Boston.
Well, I'm in Boston right now.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm on Boston Public Radio.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Bow socks win big here. Oysters are dish. State House on aspiring felons wish list.
That's great.
Tom Terrific's our hero. Our Dunkin's are donuts. No tea works, no train, no fix. Makes us all nuts.
That's great, actually. That was really good.
Thank you.
By the way, if you don't understand the State House felon thing, we had three speakers in a row of the House of Representatives, Richard, who ended up being felons.
Right.
Okay, do you want to hear my non-rhyming
okay,
one?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Again, my name is J-I-M.
J-I-M.
There you go.
Thank you.
I can't read my Rangers. Okay, here it goes. Just waiting. I'm pretty sure Marjorie has an April Fool's joke for me, but maybe not. There. So
oh
for 19
goodness.
Years.
Do you know what?
What, you forgot?
I haven't done it today.
I don't think so. So watch that was not
out.
Horrible. Was that horrible or was that acceptable, Richard? Be honest. Horrible.
I like the other one better.
So did I.
Yeah, so did I. I like the rhyming one better. I thought that was pretty good. Okay.
So explain the rules and the dates and the whatever one more time so that people can write all this stuff down.
Sure. It should be about the name of your town. The name of your town should be spelled out in the first letter of every line, right down vertically. So you just start by
That's
putting
right.
the letters of your name.
B-O-S-T-O-N.
T-O-N, and whether, you know, and then just right in between that should be something to do with the town, and that's very loose. I mean, something that you notice about the town, something, a character in the town, a place in the town, maybe Dunkin' Donuts, you know. So anything like that, that sort of, that you love and are appeal to and you like or don't like, or some anything that has to do with the town in some ways. Again, like the Zippos, you know, that capture some quality of the town and something you feel towards the town. And the acrostic is just a fun way to get you going, so to speak, to make you write that next line, right? And it's fun because it's just a process of discovery. And you could probably do, like, you guys did more than one, so you can probably do a couple and see what comes out, you know? Try a few versions. And again, don't feel like every line has to end in a period, rather. You know, the language can flow into the... I think you both did that in some ways, right? It's not like period and then starting another sentence, because that becomes a little, sometimes maybe a little too choppy, but feel free to write more across the line breaks, right? So, yeah, it'd be fun. And if we want to put some more parameters, yeah, well, I don't want to put no more parameters.
Well, I can add one.
I think we should have a prize.
It can either be your town or it can be my name. One of the two. No, that's not. And here's the deal. You got to send these acrostic submissions to us by Monday, April 29th. We'll mention it again in the interim. You have 4 weeks. You send them to our email address, bprwgbh.org. The subject line should say acrostic, so we know that it's an entrant. And a couple of weeks later, on May 13th, we will read the winning entries on the air.
And we're also going to have instructions on our website
at
WGBHnews.org. That is correct. And then we're going to read the top submissions on Monday, May 13th. And I think we should find a prize, Jim.
We will. We'll come up with a prize.
And then we'll put these online, too, and yours. And then, of course, I have to write one.
I was just going to say that. You have to submit by the 29th. What if you don't make the finals? That'd be humiliating, wouldn't it, Richard?
Yeah. Maybe I should do it anonymous just to see, like, how bad of a poet I really am. It's really funny because April is April always sort of coincides with when I have to renew my engineering license. Mm-hmm. So National Poetry Month is where we all get our poet license renewed.
You need a license.
Can you?
For,
by the way,
poetry.
Do you have in your little goodbye there when we're doing the thing in the library a second time? Great.
I'm explaining
everything.
Hey,
Richard, this is going to be huge
be
fun.
Really fun.
We're really looking forward to it. It's great to speak to you.
So am I. Well, it'll be just us three as usual and having fun and loving poetry. So it'll be great.
And Richard's too nice a guy to say that Marjorie's Boston poem clearly beat Jim's Jim call. I just want to say that in parting.
No, even I admit that it beat me.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much.
Great to talk to you, Richard.
Thank you both.
This is really fun. You guys,
yeah,
you should do
fun.
This.
It is fun. Richard Blanco joins us twice a month for Village Voice. He's the fifth inaugural poet in U.S. history. His latest book of poetry is How to Love a Country, which deals with various socio-political issues that shadow America. Now, here's the deal. On Thursday, April 25th, Richard is going to be with us in person for a reading at the Boston Public Library at 6 o'clock. Jim and I are going to be there. It should be really fun. If you haven't been to the library, it's a great time to stop by. And getting back to the acrostics, the deadline to submit your acrostics is Monday, May 29th. You send your submissions to bpr@wgbh.org. Put acrostic in the subject line. And if you're driving and you can't write this down, we'll have instructions on our website at wgbhnews.org. And we'll read the top submissions on Monday, May 13th. I think we should come up with a prize. Anyway, thank you again, Richard Blanco. Coming up, Morning Edition's Joe Matthew is here for his Havana, Cuba debrief. Listen to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Morning Edition's anchor and executive editor Joe Matthew was in Cuba over the weekend, traveling with Congressman Jim McGovern for the rededication of Ernest Hemingway's house and to further explore the Boston-Havana connection. Joe, welcome home. It's great to see you.
It's nice to be home, but that was pretty cool, I have to say.
I bet. Yeah. Well, as good as broadcasting from an elevator at 4 o'clock in the morning?
Nothing competes with that.
Oh, okay.
Now, I don't want to sound like a jealous colleague
good
here,
for
but
you,
let
Marjorie.
Me tell you something.
Good for you.
Jim and I went to Quincy about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And before that, we went to Braintree.
Right.
How'd you pull this off? A Cuba trip?
It was pretty amazing, and just a really cool experience to get a journalist visa and go to this place where we all have kind of always wanted to go and see it firsthand. But there was a remarkable series of stories to cover, as you just mentioned, Jim, not only the rededication of the Hemingway House, but the opening of a major conservation center on the property there that was put together by a lot of people from here. They call his home Finca Vigia, which means the lookout farm. And you can see from his house sweeping views of Havana. It's beautiful. You're up there in the bamboo and palm trees. And right at the site there is the conservation center. And I'm looking around at all these people from Boston. Marty Meehan is there. Bob Veal is there. Jim McGovern's there. The foundation was based here largely because of the efforts of Congressman McGovern and Frank Phillips, who you had on earlier, and his late wife, Jenny, did remarkable work here. This has been about 15, almost 20 years in the making. And they cut the ribbon on this thing, and you could see what a big deal and personal deal it was for them.
Can you go back? Many people may not know the Hemingway connection to Cuba and how long he lived there and what he did there. Give us a little bit of history.
Yeah, he actually lived there longer than anywhere else, you know, in the 40s and
50s. I didn't know that.
He actually finished For Whom the Bell Tolls there and wrote The Old Man and the Sea. That was his inspiration for this novel. He considered himself as Cuban as he was American, and he was beloved and still is on the island. People talk about him like he was a native of Cuba there. And there is a great connection to Massachusetts because at the JFK Presidential Library, that is where all of his records are stored and all of the documents and so much of the stuff that his widow, Mary Hemingway, pulled out of the house under a deal with Jackie Kennedy when they were building and designing the museum. She asked Jackie if, you know, they'd like to have these papers. And so part of the original design included the Hemingway wing, which is over there right now in Dorchester. Not a lot of people know it. There's a great exhibit you can see over there as we speak.
So can we talk about, you mentioned obviously Frank Phillips' connection. What's the president of UMass's connection, Marty Meehan?
Well, you know, we're going to talk about that later in the week. There are a number of partnerships, despite the embargo and despite President Trump's efforts to completely dismantle progress that was made in the Obama administration. Academic partnerships between schools like UMass and Northeastern that have exchange programs, biotech partnerships, medical research partnerships. There's actually a lot going on, it turns out, between Massachusetts and Cuba.
So how big of a deal is it to get there? I mean, you went as a journalist,
yeah.
But what did this entail?
It's like the amount of paperwork I had to do in advance of this thing. And then nobody tells you what's going on, and you're calling. And we got our visas about 24 hours before we took off.
Oh, my God.
We really didn't know last week if we were going to – that was several points I didn't think we were going to be there. Then you have to get the flights, and there aren't many of them. And then, of course, you arrive. And if you're, you know, Joe from Boston with a journalist visa, they want to talk to you.
Really?
And the first thing they did was dump my bag of, you know, my underwear, his computer equipment, broadcast gear all over the – and they're combing through everything, picking through everything. And they want to know where you're going to be at all times, who you're going to talk to, and exactly what kind of equipment you're going to be using. They don't allow transmission equipment for the most part because they kind of assume that everybody's a spy, I guess. But it was unlike anything I've experienced.
What if you just – by the way, when you say we, your colleague Karen Marshall and you were the
yes,
two –
Yes, that's right.
Travelers. When you say when you have to give this detailed agenda or whatever you want to call it, itinerary, what happens when you get there and you decide I want to change it based upon what I just saw or the person with whom I just spoke?
You get a phone call. Which makes you realize they know what you're doing the whole time you're there. I got a phone call from the embassy the first morning we were there in Washington with our contact, who kept calling me Matthew through those. Matthew, what are you doing? You're not where you are. And they wanted to know why I wasn't at the appointed time. How do they know I'm not? But I'm not sure I actually want to know the full details on what they were watching or aware of. But there are even only certain hotels that journalists are allowed to stay in. They really keep this. This is not freedom of the press down here. This is still, you know, a quasi-communist regime.
When you say no transmission equipment,
yes,
wasn't that a big hurdle to overcome?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, we weren't doing live shows from there. That would have been a very different, you know, the State Department would have had to help us get that in there, if at all. But they don't want satellite, they don't even want wireless microphones there because you could be broadcasting something somewhere. So we had to gather everything, and then we had to kind of get rid of our memory cards and stuff before we went back through customs, although because they notoriously like to take your SD card and stuff like that, and you don't see it again. But we got all the sound back. Internet, by the way, is not something you take for granted there. So, you know, we'd have to pay for Wi-Fi by the hour. You get these little Wi-Fi cards. It's good only for an hour. So we take our hour in, write and get all our audio together and try to get it back here to Boston.
You know, speaking of no Wi-Fi, we're talking to Joe Matthew, who just got back from Havana. Our boss, Phil Rado, texted me some of the photos you had taken.
Oh, cool.
And it really does. It looks like the 1950s. I mean, we read about it, but the cars. And
that's what you always hear about.
What's the feel like? Is it
70 years old.
Is it a feel like it's a throwback kind of thing?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, I'll answer that a couple of different ways. One cab driver put it best as we were on our way through Havana. He said, in the best English he could, he said, Cuba is a world outside of the world. Mm-hmm. And it really is. You feel like you're on another planet to a point because you're so cut off. But yeah, the cars are incredible. And by the way, you can't often tell if they're old Fords or Chevys because they've been Frankenstein with so many different parts. And these old, I won't use the term, but Russian cars that are driving around here, some poor people have to be stuck with those. But it reminded me a lot of, it was kind of a combination. I don't know if you guys have been to New Orleans, the French Quarter, the Spaconopoli in Naples, and maybe a little bit of Venice, that sort of decay that gives you that sense of, that fleeting sense of, this place is going to be here forever. And this is just, I'm lucky to be here right now.
Yeah. Kai, I want to, we mentioned Marty Meehan and Frank Phillips. I want to mention the third guy. You know, when we first started talking to Jim McGovern, when he was a lowly backbencher as a freshman in Congress, what, a decade plus ago. Now he's obviously chair of the Rules Committee.
Yeah.
In addition to hunger being one of his key issues, we know he's been on the Cuba watch from long before Barack Obama decided do
I'm really
what he
glad
did a
you
couple
brought
years
this
ago.
Up.
Tell us the history of McGovern and Cuba.
We're going to sit down with him. You'll hear an interview that I did with him in Havana on Wednesday morning. Mm-hmm. His first visit was in 1979. He was a college kid, and he wanted to join the revolution. That's the starting point.
I didn't know that part.
Oh, yeah. And he traveled all over the country, and he is passionate about it. When you talk to him about this, he's passionate about it. And I'll tell you, first of all, Jim McGovern, who was met with Fidel Castro many times, was responsible for this happening over the weekend, for ushering in what Barack Obama did at the embassy, the fact that there is an embassy down there, and is greatly disheartened by the Trump administration's efforts to turn that back and will speak very bluntly about it. He's taken an enormous amount of criticism from Republicans who call him a traitor, who say that he's treasonous for meeting with people like Fidel Castro, even having anything to do with Cuba. But he's very consistent on this, and he's very compelling when you hear him talk about it, considering the fact that we've got relations with Saudi Arabia, with China, but Cuba's off limits, despite the progress that's been made. And he speaks very eloquently about it, and I'll tell you something, you've not lived until you've gone out with, I'll call him Jim, because that's what everyone else calls him there, for a mojito in Havana. Because let me tell you something, Jim McGovern may be a mild-mannered lawmaker, but he knows how to have fun.
that's good
great.
To know.
Yes.
Did you get to interact much with regular Joe and Janes down there?
Everywhere you go, everybody wants to talk. That was something I realized quickly. Not only just to sell you stuff, which is normal in a tourist zone like that, with people who may not have a lot of money. The most compelling thing they could hear, though, is you're from Boston. The Red Sox. They want to talk baseball. That's all anybody. So I learned very quickly that if it gets a little bit weird, just bring up the Red Sox and you're good. And so I said, Poppy, Big Poppy. And you start talking about baseball because that is truly the national passion. Baseball and ballet, by the way. If you see this new Cuba IMAX movie at the Museum of Science, they spend a lot of time on that. I want to go see it again after being there. It's a really wonderful look at it.
But I would assume almost everybody we have spoken to who works in this building who has traveled the world, including our friends from the world who went to Tehran a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we said, when you were walking down the street, what did the people want to talk about? It wasn't baseball.
Yeah.
It was Donald Trump.
That's right. So I had a couple of people, by the way. It was maybe, I'd say, 2 out of 10.
Really?
They both referred to him as a cucaracha, and they wanted to know how long he was going to be around. And they say, we remember Barack
Marjorie
Obama.
Marjorie does too, by the way.
Yeah, I heard, something like that. They want to know, you know, how long is he going to be around? We remember Obama was here, Obama. And they point to the hotel where Beyonce and Jay-Z stayed, and we were so close, and now what's happening?
So what is that? Well, I guess it's only anecdotal if you've only spoken to a couple of people. Obviously, our relationship with Cuba is dramatically different.
It is.
So is there, what's their sense of America, and or was it all just personal kind of thing with you?
I think that their sense of America is great. They want to be friends. They want to talk. They want to do business. They don't get it. Mm-hmm. And to see this turn back is very confusing, I think, for a lot of people there. And that's what they're at. How come this is changing again? We felt nothing but welcome. And by the way, safe. You're walking through Havana at night. And if you just drop in there, we arrived at night. And it looks scary. I mean, you don't know where you're. It's dark. It's kind of, you know, there are some pretty tough zones in that town. Nobody ever challenged us in any way other than to say something pretty nice.
So does I want to stay on this Obama-Trump transition thing.
Mm-hmm.
Does McGovern believe that Trump's actions are anything more than a reaction to what Obama did? If Obama wants an opening, we want a closing? What's the sense of why he, being Donald Trump, decided to do what he did?
Well, I think it has more to do with the Bolton policy. And as he says, people who are nostalgic for the Cold War. Mm-hmm. But let's be honest, you know, for those of us in this room who like to cover politics, this is about Florida. This is about winning Florida. It's about winning Miami. And that's the Republican line, and that's we're going to be consistent with that.
So tell us what it's like if you were there as a tourist. It's hot.
Yes.
Palm trees everywhere. Give us a little description.
It's hot. It's really humid. You know, I've been to it's right near Jamaica and the Dominican Republic, and it's not humid like that on those islands there. Like, they told us you need a couple outfits a day, and that was true as you walk around. You can see pockets of what's most interesting are the pockets of progress where you see young people opening restaurants that have hip food and music surrounded by buildings that look like, frankly, they're somewhere in Baghdad. That are bombed out and condemned, that I suspect someday will be, you know, luxury condos if this mm-hmm. keeps going the way it is. But the contrast between new and old is really remarkable. You know, you mentioned the cars, and you see them adopting new technologies at the same time as they try to work through what's kind of an awkward growth phase for Cuba.
Yeah, but the beaches, they're supposed to be spectacular. You'd probably have a chance to get to those.
We saw a little bit of water, but I won't indulge myself in that right
now. Oh, okay. Really? Why not?
It is beautiful. It's actually on the northern side of the island, pretty rough. There's a kind of a seawall there. It's kind of like being in Marshfield with palm trees. And the waves were crashing over the wall, and there's seaweed blocking the road. There's a real kind of wild lawlessness in this place. Things change. Schedules change. We were going to find the congressman at an event at 3. Turns out they had it at 2 because the Cuban government changed the plan at the last minute. Stuff like that happens a lot. The congressman talks about the times he'll meet with the president of Cuba, whether it was Fidel or Raul or the current one. And he never knows until it's time to go. Four guys walk into a nightclub and put him in a van and bring him to the meeting.
So
that's the way it is there.
And this explained why you didn't know if you were going to be able to go until
hours before
the trip because of the paperwork was so delayed.
Keep you guessing, yeah. When we went to pick up our credentials, they made us wait hours before we were accredited. They really wanted to know what was going on, and they wanted us to work for
in Cuba.
In Cuba, absolutely.
So how long were you detained in the airport?
It was probably about an hour and a half, I'd say,
wow.
Between touching down and walking out of the place. But they definitely want to know what you're doing.
We're talking to Joe Matthew from Morning Edition. He was in Cuba last week, and he'll be in the Riviera this coming weekend. We'll talk to him next Monday.
Can't wait for that.
It sounds like it's going to be fabulous. How is McGovern viewed? I'm trying to. I don't know why I thought of this, but when Mike Dukakis was with us. Well, he's been with us a lot, but a couple of years ago when he was here, he talked about how he'd just been back to Greece, and he's greeted, obviously, as a conquering hero.
Yes.
That's a little different. But I think it's fair to say that the highest profile American elected official with the strongest positive feelings about a Cuban connection mm-hmm. is Jim McGovern. So how is he treated there?
He's known, and it's look, we're news people. If you show up at a place where McGovern is doing something public, there are a lot of cameras. They follow him everywhere he goes, at least in terms of his public stuff. People come up to him at the hotels. He's mingling with people. He likes to go out and do the bars and restaurants at night. I mean that in the most responsible way. But when Jim McGovern's in Havana, he enjoys Havana and they enjoy him. It's really something I didn't expect to see. You see this guy from Worcester, you know, on C-SPAN, or we interview him here. But this is a completely different world for him. And they really do think a lot of the progress that he's brought.
Before you go, can we go back to the Hemingway house a minute? What's it feel like? Are you a Hemingway fan, by the way?
Absolutely. And to stand in there. We got to go in places where others typically don't.
So what
get
does
to
it
go.
Feel like when you know what he did there and what he touched? And uh-huh. I mean, what's it
I'm
like?
Glad you asked that because I didn't know what to expect. And you walk on this property. It's on this big hill overlooking it. It's a beautiful view from up there, as I said. And you walk into the house. And I have to tell you guys, because so much of it is untouched. And you know that, you know, he took his own life shortly after that and never went back there. And everything was left right where it was. It's like, you know, like Pompeii, but Hemingway's house. I felt a sense of sadness, and there's a sense of tragedy still in the air. his old record player, guys, his old tube record player still sitting in the corner. If you heard our feature this morning on Morning Edition, you heard us take an actual piece at one of his records, a piece of Hemingway vinyl. We put it on the record player and it still worked.
Oh, my God.
And we listened to his albums through his old record player.
What were they? Do you remember what songs?
He had Fats Waller on there. He had Louis Armstrong on there. He had some classical music that we played this morning. He's got a magazine with JFK's face on it. His Bacardi bottle's still there near the table. It's almost a solemn, I don't know what the best word is to use, but I was taken by the feeling that probably hasn't changed since he left. You know, the pool is empty in the back, the pool he used to use every day. It's still sitting there empty with his dog's gravestones alongside of it. It's stuck in history. It's a time capsule like the rest of Havana.
Well, I've read in one of these stories how there were margin notes in 9,000 books.
Isn't that something? Yeah. Or a good fraction of those 9,000 books. Yeah. And when you go into his bathroom...
writing.
He would take his heart, his blood pressure, and record his weight in pencil on the wall every day. Oh, after he was diagnosed with diabetes, he became obsessed with his weight. And he would even write notes about what he was doing that day or what he ate or something like that. Maybe he was feeling weird about that. A lot of it had been painted over. And these guys are incredible. Led, by the way, by the president of the group is Bob Vila. Who helped to restore this home. And they had to take paint off the walls.
You should say, for the three people who don't know who
yes,
Bob Vila is.
This old house. And he was on with us this morning, too. He's the president of this group. A lot of great people that are involved in it, including Frank Phillips. But it looks exactly the way it would have the day he left.
So when are these reports going to be on? Do we know what time the rest of the week, or do you know just
Well,
flexible?
We had several this morning, which, by the way, just went up on our website. I'd love for you to go see it, and you can see Jim McGovern with the dog standing in front of the house there at WGBHnews.org. We'll have the congressman with us Wednesday, and we expect to talk with Marty Meehan about it on Friday.
That's great, Joe.
Fantastic.
Congratulations.
What a great trip.
Kind of you to talk to us about.
You know, I'm not too upset that you got to go. I am. I don't hold it against you.
Just wait till I have to talk to all the people who ask me for cigars in the newsroom. Like, that's okay. It can only take so many.
Joe Matthews, the anchor and executive editor of Morning Edition. Tune in weekdays at 4:50 a.m. for Early Edition, and stick around for Morning Edition, 5 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Great to see you.
And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to be at the Boston Public Library in the neighborhood. Stop by. Trenica's New York is going to be with us. Corby Kummer, our food man, and CNN's John King. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. Jim, what's on TV?
Well, first I'm going to discuss all the places I have not gone. For WGBH, I have a list, a running list of the thing. And then we're going to continue the Joe Biden discussion, including with a former staff person of Joe Biden, who is a big defender of his behavior and think this is much ado about not much. Ken Feinberg is going to join me. If you don't recognize the name, he's often called the master of disaster, the man who decides who gets what after things like 9/11. After the Boston Marathon, after the BP disaster. And I've got a couple of reflections on Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump, and the Special Olympics. So it's all tonight.
Sounds riveting, Jim.
I wouldn't go that far. No, actually, it is going to be riveting.
Riveting.
It is going to be riveting.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.